Starting off today's Boston Public Radio is medical ethicist Art Kaplan and his 10 things America needs to know about Ebola. Then we'll ask if we need to know how much of that $27 NFL pink hat actually goes to breast cancer. Then after Art weighs in on whether health ignorance is bliss, we'll ask you, do you suffer from the ostrich effect? Do you avoid trips to the doctor because you just don't want to know? Then Homeland Security expert Juliet Kayyem on the new Ebola czar, she actually knows him, and what really happened in Keene, New Hampshire.
Our in-house scientist Heather Goldstone on some other scientists, playwrights, and actors meeting at MIT to debate, does God exist? Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows on homeschooling your kids. Sue does. Then we'll ask you, is homeschooling some weird cult or a terrific alternative to challenge public schools? All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to hour number one of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello,
Can
Jim.
I say one thing to you?
Yes.
The debate is over.
The debate is over. And calm down. I won't have you yelling at me anymore.
No more stress. In any case, there used to be a time, Marjorie, when we talked to Art Kaplan, I don't know, about the ethics of an all-you-can-eat pasta pass. Marjorie and I remember the days when we'd call Art to talk about the quality, I don't know, of the pot brownies when he was in Steamboat,
right.
Colorado.
He was sampling.
That was when life was simpler, long before Ebola dramatically increased the death toll in West Africa and dramatically freaked out nations where the virus isn't even a viable threat. For an Ebola update and more, Art Kaplan joins us. He's fresh off a World Health Organization meeting on Ebola. Art is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Good morning, Art.
Stress? You want stress? I got stress. Plenty of stress. That's some debate, although I heard you guys are pretty good. Pretty good, as my spies tell me.
Yeah, it went well, Art. But before we get to this World Health Organization meeting, which I find absolutely fascinating, you wrote this great thing about 10 things Americans need to do and know about Ebola. We can't go through all 10, but give us what you think are the top three or four that would really be important for us.
Well, the first one is, if you don't get the epidemic stopped in Africa, we're all going to be having these conversations well into next summer because people are worried about Ebola spreading and they want to know what to do about it, et cetera, et cetera. But you've got to bring it to a halt in West Africa. So the number one thing to do is to get more building done over there so they have more beds to isolate people. You're probably going to also need some deployment of help in terms of experts, doctors, healthcare personnel from around the world to get in there. Cuba, by the way, just sent a couple hundred doctors there. So getting a handle on the epidemic there is the key to being calm and going back to the rosy days of discussions of pot over here. The second...
Before you go on to the second one, how many Americans, if you know, are already involved over there? And are we planning on sending more people?
I don't know how many private missionaries are there. There are some Americans in the Doctors Without Borders groups, but the government effort has been the military. So there are at least 3,000 U.S. soldiers in Ghana. They are building buildings primarily in Liberia. There's a similar kind of effort by the French government in Guinea. I don't know what's going on in Sierra Leone, but our major sort of boots on the ground is literally boots. It's armed service personnel trying to build more beds, and that's good. I mean, that's fine. They need those, and that's a really good form of assistance to send.
And what's number two, Art Kaplan?
So number two is don't panic. I mean, look, here's a list of things that are more worthy of worrying about. If you want to worry about dying, then don't go in the bathtub or shower. There are thousands of deaths every year from people falling down and clunking their heads in there.
Really?
Yeah. Dangerous. Slips and falls are big problems.
So bath mats. Get the bath
mats. Bath mats are very important. Don't go in the water ever because shark attacks are much worse in terms of the risk you face than Ebola. So don't do that. I would suggest not driving an I-95. I would probably suggest staying off the Mass Pike. These are dangerous places, a lot of car accidents, bad, bad, bad. Don't go there. I probably wouldn't golf because you could get hit by lightning.
Yeah, but, you know, Art, before you finish this thought, you know, you broached something that we discussed with CNN's John King yesterday about people panicking and freaking out and being ill-informed. When John was on with us yesterday, he just went through Colorado, Kansas, Iowa, a whole bunch of states in the Midwest before the election, and he was talking about conservative voters he met during his recent travels. Listen to what he says they're taking from talk radio and what they're concluding. Listen to John King.
What they're hearing is that, you know, ISIS is deliberately giving people Ebola, then sending them across the U.S.-Mexico border, telling them to, you know, spit and cough on Americans for a while and then go blow something up. And they react as if that's true.
You know, and John went on to say, who's a very respectful person, these are not dummies. These are just normal, average, hardworking people in those Midwestern states who have no clue about what's real and what's fantasy. So while that may be an extreme case, it's not as aberrational as you would like, right?
Oh, absolutely not. So we need better public education. One of the things I don't see anybody doing from reliable sources is chasing down the malarkey. There aren't going to be terrorists coming in here to spit on us because most of them would be dead if they tried to infect them with Ebola. They'd infect each other. You don't have to worry about them coming in here through the borders to get us. I would worry more about bombs and guns than I would Ebola. I think it's also nonsense that needs to be directly addressed, that the pharmaceutical industry invented Ebola so we'd all buy their pills and vaccines. And I keep seeing that up on the Internet. If there's going to be purchasing of vaccines and pills, trust me, they're going to be selling them to very, very impoverished people in West Africa. Not much business here. Just utterly ridiculous. This is the seventh Ebola outbreak since 1974. This one just got out of hand, but no terrorist and no greedy pharmaceutical company had to invent it. And there are more of these. And while we're at it, let's get after one other source of nuttiness. I've now seen on the Internet everything from take vitamins to try and swallow, and I'm not making this up, you're both going to like this, gastric juices from vultures. That apparently is a big cure in some parts of the world.
I just did that this morning. That's
yeah,
not helpful.
Well, many of us begin our days with a good dose of vulture gastric juice. But, I mean, literally, and this is true in Boston and New York, I wouldn't be surprised if that soon was available at the juiceteria right on your corner next to the ground-up kale and dirt shake that you can start your day with. Never mind that. There are no alternative medicine cures. People keep proposing them. They're selling them on the Internet. And we need to hear that not just from me, but we need to hear it from CDC. And it would be nice if we had a Surgeon General to tell us all this, which we don't because of politics.
Yeah, but on the Surgeon General front, you've been sounding that note with us and I'm sure elsewhere repeatedly. And for those who don't know, the reason that the president's nominee is being held up because he has the temerity to suggest that gun control and guns are a public health issue.
Local guy,
but,
the Brigham.
Yeah, that's right. But what that raises is instead of having a Surgeon General, I'm not defending Congress on this, he's appointed, we're not supposed to call him an Ebola czar, an Ebola strategy coordinator, whatever it is. Does it matter, like a lot of the Republican critics are saying, that this Ron Klain is not a doc, is not a doctor?
Well, I think it's fine to have somebody drive the bureaucracy along, and probably a political type is better for that. But you still need a national voice. And, you know, holding this thing up because of the gun business, if we really go through an Ebola freakout without a Surgeon General, then nobody should be back in Congress. And, you know, it's just unacceptable. You've got to either appoint this guy who's well-qualified or figure out who you want, but get somebody in there. You need that person in the full admiral's uniform with an august bearing to tell us, you know, don't swallow gastric vulture juices.
Well, you know, Art Kaplan, and we're talking with Art Kaplan, who's a medical ethicist. I see this a lot. I mean, there are people that are going to do these weird things. On let's hope most of them are on the fringes. But I see this more as a mistrust, distrust of government. You know, we've had the bad Obamacare rollout. We had the NSA, everybody spying on us. We had the, you know, IRS spying on people and stuff. And you have these assurances from people who are saying, oh, yes, we can handle it. And then it's like, whoops, no, the hospital in Dallas couldn't handle it. You've been talking about this for a long time, that certain hospitals should be centers where people go to. And there is legitimate, maybe because we don't have an Ebola czar, a surgeon general or something, that we're not getting the straight skivvy that I think scares people.
I think that does scare people. And the Dallas thing was an awful misstep, and it came early, and it was sort of the we're in control. And as you said, Marjorie, no, we're not. Uh-oh, things are bad. But remember, the only people who were endangered really, by even that slip-up, were the people in close contact with the gentleman who died, who, by the way, did not get Ebola, and they lived in the house with him for a couple of days, and our healthcare workers. How they got on a plane, I don't know, but they, too, are the people most at risk. It's healthcare workers. Unless you're a healthcare worker, or unless someone literally does spit on you or vomits on you, it's going to be pretty hard to get Ebola. Ebola is very, very, very tough to get. So we do need that reassurance that that's there, and we especially need it because of that terrible blunder. They just got off on the wrong foot. Happily, we had a guy with a fever detected today here in Newark, and he went over to a Hackensack University Hospital, which is set up to deal with people who might have Ebola or showing Ebola symptoms, and that's the way it's supposed to work. So I think now we've got a better story to tell that ought to be told.
Yeah, I know Marjorie wants to ask you about this WHO meeting that you were part of, but before we get to that, just one last thing from me. You mentioned one of the multitude of myths is pharmaceutical companies created Ebola so that they can sell vaccines, etc. Speaking of vaccines, please tell me that there are none of these ethical concerns about using untested or inadequately tested drugs on people with Ebola, considering the death rate is whatever it is, 70 or 75%. I'm assuming if a sufferer of Ebola says, give it to me, I want it, that they're assuming the supply exists, they're getting it. And people who do what you do for a living aren't advising doctors not to do it because it's untested. Are you or are you not?
So, believe it or not, that was the meeting.
That's what it was about.
So the meeting was all on the use of experimental unapproved interventions. Could be a vaccine, could be a drug, and by the way, could be blood transfusions, which you're hearing about a little bit. The idea being if you survive Ebola, you must have those little chemicals in your bloodstream called antibodies that will attack the virus, and that's why you survive, so you become immune probably, and maybe you could transfuse that to somebody else. So the general principle that we set out at the meeting, I can say, although it'll probably get announced Friday, is do try to push the usual limits. You've got to be more open to experimental interventions. Absolutely agree with that. But what you have to do is first vet the ideas. They should make some scientific sense. Not every nutty chew on bark is going to be in a clinical trial. It ought to make some sense, so there ought to be some vetting by WHO or the NIH about what they're going to let happen. We also said it would be nice if you took into account something else, Jim, Marjorie, which is, can you make a lot of this stuff in a short period of time? Because if something, a drug or a vaccine says, yeah, it looks good, but it's going to take a year to make it, that may not be the first set of things to try. So there are some pills out there that might hold promise. You can make them quickly because they're already kind of in the manufacturing pipeline for other reasons, for other purposes. Maybe you want to get into trials of that stuff first as opposed to something where you'd have to build a factory to roll it out and you wouldn't see it till late next year anyway.
You know, before we move off Ebola, we just got an email from Art from West Bridgewater, one of our favorite emailers. He's a smart guy. We've met him. I think he said he's an engineer, did he not?
He is, yes.
And maybe you can reassure him because this is what Art just wrote. Not for nothing, but if these people have no trouble finding people, that he means ISIS, to strap bombs on themselves, getting infected with Ebola and coming over here to try and infect us isn't a real stretch.
How about it, Art?
I just think it's the terrorists' worst trying to deal with Ebola back home to infect one another and then send somebody here, it's more suicidal for them over there. I think you can do just fine with bombs. I think you can do just fine with guns. I don't think you need to get to Ebola. Could you actually set it up to do it? I guess remotely you could, but it's a really tricky, it's a tricky agent to deal with, because unless you're actively infected, you're not going to be able to get somebody sick. By the time you get actively infected, you're going to be visibly worrisome to others. So I don't think.
Well, there's another thing. Most of this Ebola is happening in Africa, and the ISIS is in Syria and Iraq.
Oh, that's fair too. I mean, they're not. Yeah. So that's
they
what
have
I meant
to travel.
When I said you'd have to set it up. You'd kind of have to travel to Liberia,
exactly.
Get yourself sick, not die on the spot, get over here. I don't know. That's not a scenario I would worry about.
Okay, Art, I hope you feel better.
Not you, Art Kaplan. You, Art West from West
Bridgewater. Art from West Bridgewater. Yeah, both of you.
We're speaking to Art Kaplan, medical ethicist from NYU. I'm going to broach the next topic because this is one that Marjorie
drives me nuts.
Goes crazy about. We read the story, and I'm sure you've dealt with these kinds of things a lot, breast cancer research. There is an NFL hat, pink for breast cancer, that sells for $27. The proceeds go to breast cancer. Obviously, it causes a lot of us care about. That's pretty good. You get a nice hat, $27 goes to breast cancer, except for the fact that only $3.37 of the $27 goes to breast cancer. What obligation is there on the part of the seller, the charity, recipient, whatever, to let the unsuspecting dope who pays $27, me, for the pink hat, know what really is going to what they care about, and maybe they should write a check for $27 instead of buy the hat?
100% obligation. The notion that you have these administrative and overhead costs that eat up 75%, 80%, 90% of the money is ethically, it's just unacceptable. So you got to be transparent. I'd expect it on any website. You could put it on the hat for all I care, and say 90% of the price of this goes directly to research or the provision of services to people with breast cancer. But it ought to be transparent all the time. Little side note, I've been watching sports events and, you know, saw a lot of pink on NFL players and stuff the past month. But something I didn't hear anymore was Komen Foundation. Anybody remember them?
Yes,
and
I
the
do.
Controversy. Why don't you describe it to people?
The Planned Parenthood.
So
thing.
There's two controversies. They got themselves in the middle of the abortion fight a ways back. Now it turns out they've got a connection to the fracking industry, and a lot of people say, well, you can't work with them because some of what they do may cause cancer. So I wonder again about transparency, openness, accountability. You can give money directly to research through a lot of universities and research institutes. You don't have to come the long way around. Some patient groups, I think, are more transparent about what they're doing. But when it costs 90% of the gift to maintain the fund, that drives me nuts. There's one other thing that drives me nuts, which will make me feel better to tell you. The walks are getting longer. The last time I looked at a disease walk, people were practically walking all the way to Tierra del Fuego because they started out with like the 1 kilometer walk, and then it went to the 5 kilometer walk, and now it's like the 4,850 mile, you know, Bataan Death March to go somewhere. So,
hey Art, I'm going to stop you there. Marjorie wrote a column before she goes off about breast cancer research organizations in 30 seconds. Marjorie wrote a column in the Boston Herald excoriating people who participate in even short walks for good causes, and you know why, Art?
Traffic.
Because they block her
by my
ability
house.
To
they
try
all go sex. By my house, and
how
every
pathetic.
Sunday, you know, from in the warm weather, spring, summer, fall, you can't get out of the house.
Tell them what your breast cancer
thing
is.
Let me tell you the two things that drive me nuts about this whole thing, if I may be cynical here for a moment. Number one, the idea that the NFL is supporting women and breast cancer on the heels of their disgraceful performance involving these domestic violence with players, you know, beating up women, that they were only going to give this initial guy, what was his name, Rice?
Ray Rice.
Thank you very much. They're going to give him a 2-game suspension. I mean, please, I don't buy for 1 second that the NFL has any real – it's like a total marketing scam. Oh, look how cute we are with our little pink things to support breast cancer. And the second thing that drives
by the way, I'm hanging up now since you clearly have the ethicist role nailed down.
And the second thing is, you know – I suppose there are people who are unaware of breast cancer. I don't think there are very many. And part of what annoys me about this focus on breast cancer, and I'm not taking away for a second for the money raised and the suffering endured and all that kind of stuff, but part of me thinks that this is an opportunity for everybody to talk about breasts. And, you know, maybe we could do a little something for ovarian cancer, which is a silent killer of women with no symptoms. I mean, the awareness
of
breast...
You're not a big fan, I take it, of those, what do they call them, the booby hats?
Oh, my God. We've done radio shows on this. You can't imagine.
There's something very patronizing and infantilizing about this whole attitude toward women with breast cancer. And I hate the booby bracelets because I think it's almost insult. I know that people disagree with me, and there may be people listening who do. But, you know, I just – this whole thing gives me the creeps.
Well, the other thing that bothers me about this, as long as we're – piling on to the breast cancer situation, is I think we got to do something about breast cancer, but I'm not sure it's the leading killer of women.
I think
heart disease maybe.
Yes.
So, and, you know, you've heard me complain. I've done it on these airwaves. There are other problems in the mental health sphere. There are other serious ailments where people just aren't going to admit to them, or they're stigmatized. No one walks for them. And let me mention one of them. Why don't we have medicines for Ebola or for any of the hemorrhagic fevers or West Nile disease, which, by the way, killed 197 people in 2013, but nobody did anything about that. No one freaked out about air, you know, controlling the airports and so on. We don't have them because there's no lobby for them.
Yeah.
Nobody is organized in Washington for the Ebola might break out and come and get us lobby. So we need to have a more sane allocation of our research funds. Some percentage ought to go to infectious diseases breaking out around the world that we want to look for, you know, therapies or vaccines for, but they don't make it because there's no one to lobby for them.
Okay,
maybe
so
that's what the NFL should do.
I'm going to do one upbeat minute before we move to our final thought, because to counter what you and Marjorie have just done on this issue, I want to give a shout out, a term I never use, I can't stand it. I want to give something good to CVS. CVS, by the way, which I hope people know, stopped selling tobacco products, which to me is fabulous. That's number one. And through this CVS Healthcare Corporation, which apparently is, I guess, where they run pharmacies for other drugstores kind of thing. Listen to this, everybody. Their prescription drug plan, which charges patients more if they buy their medications at a pharmacy which sell tobacco products. I am praying you're going to celebrate this, Art Kaplan. I love it. Do you?
I do. You want the downer side?
Well, briefly, yeah.
For them to get in the healthcare business, more flu clinics. They want people in there to get health services. But you know what? I say good to that, too. I'm not... Sometimes good business can overlap good public health. The smoking thing is fine by me. And if they're going to deliver some more primary care, you know, blood pressure medicine monitoring or diabetes control or get your flu shot, I'm okay with that too. So, yeah, I'll jump on board. I think it's good.
Thank you.
We're talking with our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan. Art, there's a great piece in The Atlantic by John Fortenberg talking about this young woman, Katrina Walker, who has a 50% chance of getting Huntington's disease. Her mother has it. She's, like I said, 50-50 chance. She's young. She's 28 years old. She doesn't want to know, and she's going about her life not knowing. What is the deal? You know, how do you decide these things? Do you know? Do you not know? Is it good to know if you can do something to maybe counteract the disease or maybe get it later? What's your take on all this?
So the moral principle we go to, and I think there's some consensus for once among the ethicists about this, is if there's something actionable, something you could really do to prevent the disease, there's a strong case for trying to get the person to know. You wouldn't force them to know, but you'd really try to persuade them to know. So if you had some disease that you could take a medicine and get rid of it, good to know. We have that when newborn babies are born. We test them because certain diseases like PKU, this sort of weird genetic disease, if you get them on the right diet, get the milk proteins out of their diet and so on, they do okay. They don't get mentally retarded. And so we kind of say, you really got to know that because you got to protect the baby and we have something we can do. When there's nothing to do, I think it's up to the individual, but I'll come around and tell you a case. We had a guy come in for testing for Huntington's disease and I got a call from the lab and they said, ooh, bad news. This guy doesn't have the gene. He's not going to get Huntington's disease. And I said, well, people usually don't call me up to tell me that and say there's a problem. I said, well, here's the problem. the guy he thinks his father isn't his father.
Genetics
can reveal paternity and other things. So one of the things you have to do is get your informed consent form when it's genetic testing. You got to really make sure you're warning people. You may find out that the person you think is your parent isn't. You may find out about another test you didn't come in here to get. And I think that's part of the informed consent that has to, you got to really let the person choose, but when there's something they could do, you want to push them to get the diagnosis.
But what happened with the father thing? What did they do?
So we kicked it around. We didn't tell him because we decided he came in to find out.
I think that's the right decision.
Risk, and he's not at risk. And we let it go.
Yeah.
And we just thought, but we fixed the informed consent forms.
Hey, before you go, though, I want to get back. I totally understand and agree with the notion if there's nothing you can do about it and the person doesn't want to know, then fine. What happens in a situation where a medical professional knows that person has X, that it is totally curable, but it's only curable if they do Y, whatever is take certain medication, do whatever, and the person says, I don't want to know. Well, I really think you should. Well, I'm telling you right now, 100%, spoken to my priest, I've spoken to my whatever, I do not want to know, and you know that their information aversion, it's called the ostrich effect, I love that expression, their information aversion is going to kill them, and you could cure them. What does the doctor or nurse or whatever do?
So we get that every once. I mean, it's rare, but we do get it. I think you have to respect it, but you keep trying. So even if you lose on the first one, you try a revisit. You lose on that one, you try again. So you keep, you know, nagging, basically, like my mother did to me about grooming and other things. Maybe not the first time, but we'll get there on the second time. So I think you got to keep at it. Don't give up. And it comes up. You know, think about girls with anorexia. There are things they can do, but they say no, and there are things they can do, but they say no, and doctors can get pretty frustrated dealing with young women who say, I don't want to hear about it. I like starving to death. And that's an area, for example, where you just have to keep at it and at it and at it.
Just one quick last thing, Art Kaplan. Alzheimer's is no gene. It's you might get it. There's a family predilection, I understand, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So is there anything, because a lot of people with parents with Alzheimer's, so forth and so on, are very scared of it. What can they do? Is there anything they can do?
So about 10% of Alzheimer's seems to be linked, strongly linked to genetics. The rest, we don't know why it's happening.
Okay.
Is there anything you can do? Well, people love to say do Sudoku puzzles and do brain training. I have to tell you, I don't see any evidence that prevents or slows Alzheimer's. I don't think it's bad if you like to do puzzles to do them. It may give you a kind of social engagement that's good, but this notion that the brain is like a muscle and you work it out and that helps it get stronger to defy Alzheimer's, I'm sorry to say, I don't think it's there.
But can't you see it coming if you have someone look at your head?
You could. There are certainly signs of Alzheimer's that could be detected in CAT scans, in functional MRIs. We're just not there yet to do it, but I suspect that kind of testing, Marjorie, is going to be here in a couple of years. It's coming very fast.
Okay. Hey, Art, before you go away very quickly, where do you get that vulture urine again? Where does that come from?
Gastric juices.
Oh, gastric juices.
Urine by
gastric. Sorry, excuse me. I got it. Okay, forget.
I think you need a vulture. So you're probably going to have to go to India or someplace with some vultures flying around.
Thank you.
Okay.
Art, it's a pleasure as always.
Thank you very much.
You.
Art Kaplan is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center. Managed to keep his sense of humor through all these things, Jim.
It is
he
amazing,
He also
actually.
Co-hosts the Everyday Ethics Podcast. Coming up, we're going to ask you, when is health ignorance bliss? Do you do what you can do to avoid a doctor's appointment? Are you afraid of going to the doctor? That's next on 89.7 WGBH. Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And if you're just tuning in, we were talking to medical ethicist Art Kaplan about health ignorance bliss, about how not knowing about your health cuts down on stress and anxiety. Do you do what you can to avoid any kind of a diagnostic test? Have you wormed your way out of your annual mammogram? Do you fail to schedule that colonoscopy you were supposed to get? Or are you someone who would rather know everything instead of letting your imagination run wild? Our number is 877-301-8970. As I said, I'd never heard the term before until I read this Atlantic piece you mentioned by this Fortenberry guy. Information aversion is the description of that first set of people. And the term that's more in common use is the ostrich effect. And I have to say, knowing Marjorie a little bit like I do, we are at opposite ends of the spectrum on this, are we not?
Well, Jim, you know, how many MRIs have you had, Jim?
I've had a few diagnostic exams in my time.
Yeah, it seems to me, you know, many times, I think we're maybe up to a couple of dozen times, Jim, so I have to leave early to getting an MRI. And I said, what's wrong? Well, I'm just checking things out, making sure everything's
getting
okay.
Getting a B12 shot today at 2:15. Oh. Not to... I need to let you know, but I am. I want to know.
B12 shot.
It's a long story.
What is that for?
I don't know. But let me just tell you something. Why not? I am somebody. I'm serious, by the way, because my imagination runs wild and always runs to the worst possible scenario about everything. I want to know everything. I want to know everything. If I've got a minor thing, fine. If I've got something serious, I want to know it. And even in the case that Art Kaplan mentioned, if you have something serious that's unfixable, I want to know it because you'd like to know. Well, I have 2 years to live, so maybe I'd like to plot out what my 2 years are. But there's some people for whom health ignorance is bliss. What's your take? 877-301-8970. And by the way, we'll try to stay away from death and destruction, even though it's hard to ignore. It's sort of the normal. Do you not even go to the doctor or not go? If you're not feeling particularly well, you don't go because I really don't want to find I have X and I'm going to have to take some treatment. I'm going to have to miss 3 days of work. I would bet, I've never seen a poll on this, I would bet that more Americans are into the health ignorance is bliss category.
Well,
and by the way, not because they can't afford medical care. Leave that off the table for the moment. But just because they believe what you don't know probably won't hurt you.
But I think there's a big generational thing here, or maybe it's an Irish thing. I don't know because my whole family's Irish. But
yeah.
I certainly spend a lot more time going to the doctor and taking my children to the doctor than my parents ever did. I mean...
Well, your kids are different than yourself. I mean, I think almost everybody.
Well, there was a lot less doctor going when I was a kid. I mean, it was always, you know, just take a couple of those little orange aspirin, St. Joseph's aspirin for children, and go to bed. You know, we weren't running to the doctor all the time. And my parents were never running to the doctor. I think that we're much more health conscious. And maybe those people that are ignorance is bliss, but they were like over the top, ignoring all these symptoms. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. And also, it's not so long ago that you couldn't really find things out. You know what I mean?
I'm anxious, by the way, just thinking about it. I mean, I literally.
Well, Jim, let's face it, you're a big time hypochondriac.
I'm careful. I am careful.
I am careful. I mean, you're never sick. You're always here. You're very healthy as far as we know.
I don't have many sick days,
right? You spent more time. I mean, you were like the reason they need Obamacare just to rein you in.
Since you brought it up, and I wouldn't have brought it up otherwise because it is self-congratulatory, I was very proud when I was admitted to the MRI Hall of Fame last year. I was their 13th inductee. And it was,
yeah, you like Woody Allen, and nobody likes Woody Allen anymore because of all his multiple problems. But you know, when he had like 17 doctors on retainer, and Hannah and her sisters, when he goes and he calls up and to call his doctor, and they say, well, it could be a brain tumor. And then he goes, oh, my God. But you know what? That's why you shouldn't go on those medical MD things, because you could have like a pain in your back.
I mean, the websites.
The websites, yeah. You could have a pain in your back, or maybe your finger's hurting, and you know, the best case scenario is you sprained your finger. The worst case scenario is you have a massive tumor.
Well, it's
in your
a
palm
CYA
of your hand.
Kind of thing.
Yeah, you become hysterical. So it's not a good thing to read those.
You
things.
Know, one example of somebody we both know pretty well, Charlie Pierce, who you probably have heard of. He's a phenomenal sports writer, but he's also just a great writer. He wrote a book a few years ago. We interviewed him about this. I think it was called Hard to Forget. There's Alzheimer's all throughout his family. And so I don't know what the percentage risk is, but the risk is relatively high when you've got it at least on one side of your family. And whatever side that is, he had. Do you remember what his decision was about testing when Alzheimer's? We interviewed him when the book came out, I think right about the time that Alzheimer's testing became pretty relatively reliable. Do you remember what he said?
You know, it's embarrassing because I read the book and I was fat. Charlie Pierce is a wonderful, beautiful
writer.
And he talked about how every time he forgot somebody's name or forgot some fact, he became into a panic. But I don't remember what his decision was.
He didn't want to
know. Okay.
And you know, I have to say, despite the description, well, I don't know where I would be on that. I mean, I just said that I want to know everything. I don't know if I want to. I don't know what I want. 877. I really don't. I don't know if I want to know. I don't know if I don't want to know.
Just keep getting the MRIs, Jim.
It's called the ostrich effect, and we want to know if you suffer from it. Do you decide? I just don't want to know about my medical stuff. I don't whether it's minor, major, et cetera. I just want to just blithely go ahead and live my life.
You know, here's a good email from Christopher in New Hampshire. He says he hates going to the doctor because the doctor makes him feel guilty, like I'm always doing something wrong, especially the dentist, which is a different thing. And
that's a whole different kind of thing. It's about a decision and information aversion behavior. You are averse to knowing information, and you figure. I mean, the calculation. I wish we had our friend Michael Norton. Michael Norton.
Yes, from Harvard Business School.
Who does all these behavioral things? Is what causes you more stress? This is what this is really about. I hadn't thought of this till just now. Is it more stress worrying and not knowing, or is it more stress knowing, even if the news is not great? And having it, obviously, the best feeling is you know and everything is perfectly fine. But it's all about stress management, is it not? Isn't that the calculation you're making subliminally when you decide, I'm going to go to the doctor because I want to know X, Y, or Z, or I don't want to go because, frankly, I want to be ignorant and I'll be happier.
Yeah,
yes?
I think that's absolutely it. Let's go to Marie from Shrewsbury. What do you think, Marie?
Hello, Marie.
Okay. First of all, Jim, I could match the MRI for MRI.
I don't think so, my friend, but go ahead.
Here's the thing. About 8 years ago, I had some funky symptoms. Long story short, I had an MRI in my head, and my primary care called and said, well, we thought it was this, we were worried about this, it's not that, but we found a small aneurysm in your brain.
Yikes.
Which a lot of people have, and people don't know unless they, drop dead. About a month later, developed a headache, went into the hospital, aneurysm had grown, but they said, no, it's okay, we're going to watch it. I went on vacation, I'm on the vineyard, I get a call 4 days later from the neurosurgeon, he said, you've got to come right back, we've got to fix this right away.
Yikes.
It's worse than we thought. I went back. A week later, I was like, well, when do you want to do it? He said, today. So I went back, and it probably, in reality, saved my life. So now I want an MRI every month of every part of my body.
Can I tell you, by the way, since Marie, I should just say, since Marie and I can commune over MRI, I don't know how big you are, Marie. I'm large. I'm 6'5". Going into an MRI, and I've had a lot of them, is like literally being wheeled into your casket. That's number one. And number two, I've had my head. I can't believe I'm going into this with Marie. I've had my head MRI too. Did they put your head in that little cage thing where you can't move it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. Is that terrifying?
Six times.
Oh,
and okay.
Yes, but I just closed my eyes.
It's not enough.
It probably saved my life. So now I tell people, listen to your body. If you're feeling something funky, you just keep pushing.
Okay, hold on, Marie, because you've hit on my big fear, which is aneurysms. What was your initial symptom, please, that caused you to call the doctor?
I had some numbness in my face, and I felt like I was drooling. I kept saying to my friends out to dinner, "Am I drooling?"
Oh, that's big
They're
deal.
Like, you're out of your mind. Yeah. Well, and then it would come and go, and I was like, "Oh, I felt great."
No headaches initially.
Not initially, no. And they were like, well, just keep an eye on it.
Okay.
Now I'm a nurse. My husband's a doctor. He got the call on the vineyard. My kids, I just went in and had it coiled. They did this really cool thing, and it fixed it. But about 2 years later, my kids said, hey, you know, we just read about aneurysms. You could have been really sick, like drop dead.
Yeah,
I mean,
no, it's true.
So,
young people.
Hey, Marie,
that was a great call.
We're
now
glad
I'm nervous
you're well.
Wreck
you're a good storyteller.
About aneurysms.
No,
young
but
people.
There's a moral to that story. The moral to that story is that my approach on most things like that is right.
Okay.
If there's a symptom,
if you see me
go
drooling,
call up.
Jim, tell me to get
myself.
No,
I'm serious.
Bob from
Boston.
But
by the way, I mean, what? I hate to be morbid, but since she brought it up, she'd be dead if she hadn't pursued this.
Young woman, when my kids were little, a parent, mother of little kids, aneurysm in her head in the driveway. It was horrible.
Really?
Yes. Bob from Boston. What do you think?
Hey, Bob.
Hi, I'm calling. I'm a physician.
Oh, great.
I'm calling because I want to give you a somewhat different perspective on this. And
sure.
That is, why wait until you're sick to go for your tests? I have a practice, and my patients are all actually fairly healthy. And the reason they come to me is they want to stay that way. And there's so much that can be discovered in testing that is preventable or at least alterable if you determine that there are metabolic issues that can be rectified early on, rather than waiting until you've got the signs and symptoms that drive most people to see their physicians. And they can be picked up often with blood tests or simple x-ray tests. An example, I have a lot of athletes, and most of them, in fact, overtrain. And the overtraining can be really deleterious to their health. And they don't know it because they think they're really buff and they're fit. But it's a stressful life endeavor, and those stressors create other problems downstream that don't manifest themselves until the body finally says uncle and can't go any further with it.
Hey, Bob, let me ask you a question. As a doc, I'm assuming that your approach to medicine is also much more embraced by insurance companies than it was 20 years ago. If someone had your philosophy 20 years ago, you'd have to say to your patient, the bad news is you got to pay because to stay healthy as opposed to coming to me when you're sick. But right now they're much more conscious about prevention. Are they not funding prevention than they are just taking care of sick people?
No.
No?
They're not. In fact, my practice is more akin to the one you described.
Really?
Yeah, my office visit, my first office visit, my patients is between 3 and 4 hours.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, there's a lot of analysis going over in a lot of detail, past history, what things may have been going on earlier on in your life that could contribute to the very subtle symptoms. A lot of people pass things off that they don't think are important, but they really contain clues to things that are kind of festering that haven't really manifested themselves.
Okay, Bob, I think two very important things. Number one, I think you should email Jim Browdy because you sound like the kind of doctor that he
I was
would like to
tell
be
him to hold on, obviously. I am going to tell him to hold on so we can get his name and number.
Do you have any brain aneurysm tips before you go? I mean, the previous caller said drooling. I'm wondering if it's headaches. This is the thing that scares me. Anything quick, Bob?
Unfortunately, brain aneurysms, unless you have a real diagnostic test that shows that you're not going to know.
Okay.
Hey,
maybe
Bob, I am serious.
Stay
on hold. We may want to have you back on the radio. Stay on hold. One of our producers
maybe
is going to take your name and number.
Is that the cage
number.
Thing?
Thanks,
do I need one of those cage things, Jim? Is that what
no,
I need
the
for
cage
the brain
thing,
aneurysm?
Just so you know, so it doesn't get too scary for people, when you're doing an MRI, you can't move.
Yeah.
And so if the particular part of your body, like in Marie's case and mine, was my head at one thing, some neurological,
why
whatever.
Why are you having your head
I don't remember. Because I hadn't had my head scanned in a while, so I figured, why? No, I don't know what it was. Your head can't move, and your head would naturally move, so they put you in this sort of head cage.
Head cage.
That makes sure that your head can't
I think I might have to try it.
This is one of our more upbeat discussions.
This is why you don't want to talk about these things. You know why? Because you become hysterical about all your symptoms.
No, can I tell you something? You know how wrong you are? Bob,
I'm in a panic.
Bob, the doctor, talked about preventive care, which is what I'm disappointed that I should have known better, that insurance companies are still not funding it. That's the way you should approach your health, not wait till you're sick. And Marie talked about listening to the warning signs in your body.
Okay.
And as a result, she's a healthy woman as opposed to a dead woman.
I'm going to have to make an appointment for that head cage right after the show is over at 2 o'clock. But in the meantime,
when's
I'm going to continue talking.
I'm going to buy you a coupon.
We're going to continue talking about this, even though it's making me very nervous, at 877-301-8970. Quick break, right back.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. We're talking about, and we were talking about, health ignorance being bliss, or is it not? Earlier, we started the discussion with medical ethicist Art Kaplan about when it's okay to not know about your health. We want to know where you are on this. The terms for it, both of which I love, is the phenomenon is called information aversion, or I guess more colloquially, the ostrich effect. We've had actually some great calls so far. Where are you on this? Are you happier if you know more, you feel more in control, or would you be more anxious, stressed, if you learn that you're at risk for a disease that you really couldn't do anything about? 877-301-8970.
Janice from Cambridge. Thank you for calling, Janice.
Hey, Janice.
Hey, thanks, you guys. I love your show.
Thank you.
I had something I wanted to say, and now I've been listening to a couple of your callers, and now I'm already changing my own mind.
Give it to us.
But I originally thought, and I still really do think, and just wanted to say quickly, that I think people do tend to consistently underestimate the power of the mind-body connection. And I do think what Jim was saying about Michael Norton, I guess, did he say?
Yeah, he's the business school
great.
Guy that we have in.
Yeah, behavioral economist. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, stress is a problem. Stress causes disease. So if you, which is another way of saying that your mind can affect what's going on in your insides. And me personally, I'm kind of like both of you, I'm terrified of being ill. I'm terrified. So I kind of don't want to know, but I have also had an experience in my life where that turned out to benefit me.
Hal, give us a quick version if you can.
I don't, to be honest, I can't. It's a little embarrassing.
Okay, fine. That's fine.
Personal, but I actually was told, you know, this could have been a lot worse, but you ignored it you, in your mind, decided it wasn't an issue, so it was not an issue.
Can I tell you something, Janice? If you had talked to me 20 years ago and spouted this mind-body rhetoric thing, I would have been polite to you, but I would have been making a face at Marjorie. I am such a total believer in this, not in a mystical way, but it is obvious. I mean, think about your daily life. When you're stressed and upset and about something, you feel, you physically feel the impact of it. It's so obvious. It's ridiculous that some people are still resisting. Why are you smiling me in a weird way?
I'm thinking of these cloistered nuns and these monks. They live forever.
What is that about? Oh, because there's no stress?
Because they're meditating all day and praying all day.
So I guess fun is overrated. Is that your point? Hey, Janice, thank you for a fine call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. We're talking about the ostrich effect, information aversion when it comes to health care and whether health ignorance is bliss.
Ellen from New Hampshire. What do you think, Ellen?
Well, I'm going to tell you a little story.
Sure.
Back in the middle 60s, my grandmother was diagnosed with uterine cancer. And my mother and her sisters went to the same doctor as my grandmother. So they begged the doctor not to tell her because they said, you know, when people hear the word cancer, they give up. So back in the 60s, doctors would kind of go with that because it was all of the sisters, you know, all of my grandmother's daughters, and they're saying that. And so he told her that she needed a hysterectomy because she was having some women's issues, so she went with it. And 5 years later, she was invited to a dinner. And at the dinner, she received, and actually when they got in there to take out, to do the hysterectomy, she had just started with ovarian cancer also. They got into the very early stages. And they gave her an award 5 years later for being cancer-free for 5 years. And she said, I never even knew I had cancer. And guess what? She lived to 104 years old.
Wait a second, that is not true. She got the award and she didn't know that she had had cancer to begin with.
Never known she had had cancer. Nobody ever told her. They just, because my mother and
that
her
is a great story.
People would give up. And it was a doctor in Quincy and he was a very fine man. And because the girls, my mother and her sister, were so insistent about how people give up. And it's really true. Some people, when they hear the word cancer, they give up. She lived to 104.
You know, Ellen, you've brought up another one of my favorite subjects that drives me crazy. We were just talking before about breast cancer. And everybody gets mammograms now, as well they should. And sometimes they, you know, you detect cancer on your own. But in any case, they could look for other cancers, ovarian and uterine cancer in women, and spot them early, but they don't. And I think it has to do with, like everything else, money. You know,
well, it's not just money. We talked to, and Ellen, that was a fabulous story. Thank you for sharing it. Remember the conversation we had a month or two ago with Art Kaplan, who we just hung up on a few minutes ago, about the whole issue, the debate in the medical profession? If I get this a little wrong, please correct me, because I don't want to be giving incorrect advice on something so important, about whether or not certain prostate cancer tests are advisable. Because often there'll be a positive for something that is cancerous, but is so unbelievably minor that people overtreat it. So many doctors are recommending that you not get the test, even though they're relatively reliable, because when you see the C word, you overreact. So, I mean, you know, there are a whole bunch of different...
Yeah, I think it's a lot. I'm looking at this from the women's perspective and thinking there's something about it's being a women thing with ovarian cancer. And maybe if there were more awareness about that, then there'd be much of more of a brouhaha to have that be a routine thing that women get. But anyway.
Can I tell you, if there were a subgroup of society who I admire, since we've spoken a lot about cancer and this, oncological nurses.
Oh, they're great.
Particularly for kids. There was a story in the Globe, I don't know, a couple of years ago, the Globe magazine, or was it the Times magazine? One of the Globe magazine, about nurses, men and women nurses, who are in the oncology ward, pediatric ward, and what they do and the strength they give these kids and the courage is just, they really are otherworldly.
Let's go to Bob from Arlington. Hi, Bob. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Bob.
Hi, good morning. How are you today?
We're excellent. Thank you.
Look, before I start here, let me just give you a quick congratulations on last night. That was a wonderful, wonderful job. I enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you, Bob.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Jim, I'm just sorry you couldn't find a way to sneak in the word cementatious, but
if you weren't listening yesterday when we had this old house on, Tom Silva used the word cementatious, which was some kind of cement, and it became the storyline for the rest of the show. But Bob, thank you about last night. We were glad
too. And Marjorie, I'm glad you didn't oversleep in your car and miss the whole thing. But
Thank you, Bob.
You know us well.
Go ahead, Bob.
I was telling your producer that, you know, going back 3 or 4 years ago, anytime I had something little going on with me, and back then I was a pretty healthy guy, and I would go to my doctor, and I think part of that, he would just kind of blow it off almost. And I think a lot of physicians are under so much pressure to see so many people, and they're not really giving you their 100% attention when people come in with complaints. As a result, I think people start to blow things off, and I started doing the same thing, and eventually I had to find a new primary care because I started getting a few things again, and I'd say, I'll treat it like my car. You know, my car's making a noise. Give it a couple of weeks, it'll go away. Well, sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't. But I think people are up in the air, and part of it, I think, is due to, well, what is my doctor going to say? Is he going to call me a hypochondriac? Is he going
to... Can I tell you something, Bob? Let me tell you where I disagree. The half I agree, the half I don't. Because of the pressure from the insurance companies, there's no question that doctors are under incredible pressure to see you more quickly. Actually, one of my primary care physicians who I went to for years, who I love, left the practice for 10 years.
I wonder if she loves you, Jim.
I left the practice for... You actually know her. Well, left the practice for 10 years because of that pressure, even though she's one of the most committed physicians I ever met in my life, and now she's back doing it in another sort of forum. But I think the problem in the medical profession is the opposite, Bob, is that because of the shortness of time and the fear of lawsuits, I think people overdiagnose, if that's the right word. And that's why there's so much testing. And that's one of the reasons medical care is so expensive, because doctors don't want to take a chance that they let you leave the office. You have something horrible that they didn't test you for. You know what I mean?
I see your point. I guess, you know,
Prevention.
Prevention, yeah.
Ounce of prevention worth a pound of cure.
Well, that's what it is.
There
you go,
yeah. I guess so. Maybe doctors are going that route. But from a personal standpoint, I started saying to myself, you know, I'm not going to be gone anymore, because every time I've gone, you know, thankfully it never
really
turned.
Yeah, but Bob, let me stop you right there. Then I don't want to give you advice, but I'm going to give it to you anyway. Find the right doctor. Don't not go because you've had a bad medical experience. A good doctor is like a pound of whatever.
That's right.
What are you doing? Bob, thanks for the call.
I'm holding up my finger.
Was your finger bent?
My bad doctor experience. Yes, it is.
What happened to you?
I told you this a million times.
What's that?
I have a broken finger because they kept telling me it wasn't broken, and now it's like mangled. It's a disgrace. But anyway,
by the way, a lot of people were talking about your mangled finger last night.
I think the takeaway from this segment, Jim, is that you better all go to a monastery. Before you go to the monastery, get the head cage so you can check for
No, you know what? The ostrich effect, I understand it in the most serious situations, but it's generally not a good thing.
Okay, coming up, we're going to talk to
listen to your body.
Your body and then run and get the MRI.
Okay.
Coming up is our Homeland Security expert, Juliette Kayyem. Needless to say, we got a lot of Homeland Security stuff to talk about with her. Stay tuned to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
We'll kick off hour two of Boston Public Radio with Homeland Security expert Juliette Kayyem on the new Ebola czar, she knows him, and what really happened in Keene, New Hampshire. Then Globe editor Brian McGrory joins us. We'll do a debrief on the Globe GBH governor's debate, Shaheen versus Brown in New Hampshire, and then talk of the life and times of legendary Washington Post and Watergate editor Ben Bradley.
Our in-house scientist Heather Goldstone on some other scientists, playwrights, and actors meeting at MIT to debate, does God exist? Then Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows on homeschooling your kids. Sue does. We'll ask you, is homeschooling some weird cult or a terrific alternative to challenged public schools? All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. Welcome to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hi there, Marjorie. So we might call this segment actually a nightmare at the opera. You might not think of Juliet Kayyem as our resident opera critic. Jared Bowen usually wears that title. Who better, though, to weigh in on John Adams' opera? It's called The Death of Klinghoffer. It's about a Jewish man in a wheelchair. He was murdered by Palestinian terrorists after they hijacked his cruise ship. This is a true story, by the way, if you don't recall it. The plot also digs into the historical roots of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and the controversy and protests surrounding the Metropolitan Opera's current production of this work has resulted in the largest police presence at Lincoln Center in New York City ever. Homeland Security expert Juliet Kayyem joins us every Wednesday for Open Mic. She has her take on this story, and we have others, too. Juliet, good to see you.
Thanks for having me today.
Hey, Juliet. So there's several hundred protesters, as Jim just said, outside Lincoln Center. They're led by the City University of New York trustee. His name is Jeffrey Weisenfield, and he was picketing before the Met's opening of the play, and a lot of them are still there. Here's what this guy said, this Weisenfield guy said. You will be made to destroy that set. We'll demand it. It doesn't belong in this city. We're going to be back here, everyone here, and many more nights, every night of the Klinghoffer Opera until the set is burned to the ground. Now, we presume he's exaggerating here.
Let's hope so.
But this does present a secure, I mean, it's yeah. You know, Palestine, Israel, potential here for
right.
problems.
And New York City. I mean, look, I mean, anyone who treads into this morass of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, even the opera is going to face criticism, and good for them for continuing to hold it. It is a widely acclaimed, critically acclaimed opera. It is the criticisms of it are that it may seem too pro-Palestinian.
Because it shows them as humans, not uncritically, but shows that they're actually people who may be screwed up or not. But and obviously in this case screwed up. But as people, that's the complaint. It humanizes.
Yeah,
them.
That's exactly right. And that's actually what opera's supposed to do, and that's what art's supposed to do. I mean, some of the greatest. There's great literature. There is great photographs. There is an opera about very difficult issues that try to humanize conflicts that seem ahuman, not humane right now. And I really have to say, I mean, the pressure that the opera is getting is tremendous. It brought Giuliani back out to complain about it. And good for the mayor for standing firm. It is a security
De Blasio standing firm?
Yes, De Blasio standing firm.
And what was Giuliani saying?
Giuliani was saying that this, you know, brings out, you know, this is too humanizing and that we, you know, and there's going to be too much conflict and we need to bring it down. And it's just ridiculous.
But when Commissioner Evans was here and he's talked proudly about the marathon after the horrible marathon and how they really want, well, they wanted everybody to be safe. And I think there's an analogy here, obviously, even though there's a lot of difference, too. Keep everybody safe. But in keeping everybody safe, we don't want to scare the you-know-what out of people, right. Which is, I assume, a dilemma that a Homeland Security type like you faces all the time. How do you strike that balance?
It's almost impossible, or I guess I put it a different way. You do it on a case-by-case basis. So the goal of a marathon, the goal of opera, the goal of theater, the goal of art is to be both open and secure. And that balance is going to differ over time, including the threat. This guy's language about we're going to break down the set is just absolutely ridiculous. It's a the visitors to the opera need to feel safe and secure. But, nothing is going to be perfectly safe. And having a First Amendment right for art to humanize people that we may even think are inhuman is important because over time, the conflict that arises and the differences of opinions will only be resolved when both are given a full hearing, even if it's through song and opera. And that's, I think that's important.
You an opera fan, boy?
No, you know, I'm a country music fan.
You are not.
Rascal Flatts.
I love Rascal Flatts.
Are you
really? Is that really true?
Yeah. I'm a long-distance runner, and I put on Rascal Flatts on Pandora, and I run and hear all that music. It drives my daughter crazy. She's like, every song's the same. The women are in short jeans. The men are drinking beer. I mean, it's true. But I am not an opera fan.
You know, the thing about that drives me a little bit crazy is when people protest something that they haven't read or they haven't seen. And many of these protesters admit they haven't even seen it. So it's hard to know how humanized the Palestinians are. And as I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, they didn't just shoot this Klinghoffer guy.
Horrible.
He was an elderly man in a wheelchair. They threw him overboard.
Off, yeah.
alive.
Live on TV. You and I remember that vision.
Yes. And so you have to think the terror of knowing he was going overboard, the time it took him to actually get overboard and dump him overboard. You know, it wasn't – so how humanized can you be when this is what
right.
you did to helpless person?
Right. But, I mean, look, it is – in some ways it reflects what they did is the same as why is ISIS in our minds such a horror? Because they're using the visuals of fear to terrify us in much greater ways than maybe their power would suggest. So I remember being a teenager. I don't remember what year it was and seeing that and just, you know, thinking
– horrified.
Horrifying. And very similar to why are we sort of obsessed with the ISIS videos. But I agree with you. But look, I mean, there's a bigger story here, which is, of course, a conflict that hasn't been resolved in your and my lifetime and hopefully might be resolved in our children's lifetime. And art is a way to reflect. I mean, think about Claire Massoud's book on 9/11. I'm forgetting the name of it. Something of the City. I'm sorry, Claire.
Yeah, but she got a lot of blowback.
Yeah, and I mean, it just, you know, but these books open up a window.
Well, you know what's another high-profile, much more popular example? And it obviously strikes very close to home, the cover photograph of Jahar
exactly
Tsarnaev.
Right.
And obviously everybody remembers that. There was this wild protest against Rolling Stone. Why? It's called The Emperor's Children, the book.
The Emperor's Children, thank you.
Thank you, Amanda. Because it humanized them, because it showed him, described him in ways in his pre-alleged marathon bombing days, as a fairly likable, normal kid. And, you know, the thing that drove me nuts about that.
It was also the attractiveness of the shot.
But, I mean, I said then, and I'll say now, look, Rolling Stone has every right to show that picture, and we have every right to complain about
it. Of course.
But the depths of, I mean, the beauty of that picture, because he did look like a stunning teenage
kid.
To show that radicalization was happening.
Amen, exactly. And the most unlikely
and the
kinds
most
of places.
Down the street.
Yeah.
And down the street.
Just a quick aside on that. I wrote a column in the Herald saying that this is going to be are you a lawyer?
Yes.
Yeah, I thought so.
I did.
Okay. One of the things, as you know, if being being a lawyer is that juries who sit there day after day after day begin to sympathize with the defendant.
Right.
And if the defendant is an attractive defendant, O.J. Simpson, or this young man, I mean, I saw him at the federal courthouse, the alleged bomber, Tsarnaev, and he's small. And he,
during the arraignment, you were
during
there.
During the arraignment,
yeah.
Yes. He's small and he is attractive looking.
Yeah.
And that's going to play a role. It's not fair. It's not right. But it does. And you would have think you would have thought that I, you know, nominated him for Man of the Year with the vitriol, just to point that out. You know that
right.
you were coddling terrorists, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it is true, and it is a factor.
You know, I love the way she asked the question. You didn't hear it the way I did. It was sort of like, hey, are you a lawyer?
I know. And you know, here's the thing. I did practice. I was at the Department of Justice during the Clinton administration. I practiced for 6 years. I haven't been in a courtroom since 1999. And I pay my bar dues every single year. And that's like my mother in the back of my head saying, you are a lawyer. You always have something to fall back on.
Yeah.
I've been playing a couple hundred every year. You know, it's
are you aware of the fact I haven't been in a courtroom in several decades? I was about to say, until I realized the one time I was in the courtroom when I was on trial, Marjorie was my only witness, and she had to be called by my lawyer, the former president of the Massachusetts Bar, as a hostile witness.
Yeah. Oh,
because
wow.
She was not willing to testify in a truthful and honest way.
He wanted me to fudge the facts.
I did not. Okay,
that's why.
Let's move on. Here's the
okay,
deal.
As your lawyer,
because
I still have my I suggest you plead the fifth right now on air.
Okay, let's move on.
I will not move on. But
hey,
can I just go back to opera? First of all,
yeah.
You know, first of all, I'm still dumbfounded by the whole Rascal Flatts thing. And,
yeah,
you know,
ahead.
I mean, I love it. I love it.
Too.
But look, art, whether it's about the terrorist attack or a terrorist attack, or it's about a city, you know, like Claire Massoud's book or Amy Wallman's book or a number of books that have come out, can help us reflect and also put pieces together that we might not otherwise
Absolutely.
Have. And
so,
it's a silly, silly conflict. But like all things related to the Arab-Israeli conflict, it becomes political.
Right. And you don't have to like them. You don't have to accept them.
God,
as you
no.
said, just consume them and then
right.
deal with it. Let's move on to this Ebola thing. We talked about the sort of the medical thing with Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist, a little while ago. But I want to talk about Ron Klain and the uproar over, by the way, the first uproar, this drives me nuts. Remember how the Affordable Care Act couldn't be Obamacare because that was critical of the president and the act until the president himself said, I like it when you call it Obamacare. So then it became okay. We learned in the last 24 hours he is not the Ebola czar. He is the Ebola strategic coordinator or whatever the hell he is. Do you know
Ron, and I thought it was a great pick because every crisis has like I have dealt with many times has two responses. One is the operational one, which is all the doctors and the CDC and NIH fighting Ebola, both abroad and here. The other is the political response, which clearly the White House was dealing with. It is Congress. It is the governors. It is every state public health facility and apparatus. It is about preparedness and essentially making people feel like the White House had grip. It was losing the storyline and people were losing perspective. So Ron comes in, to manage that other piece. It was a role I played during the BP oil spill. I served as director of intergovernmental and interagency response. I didn't deal with, boom and cleaning up the oil. I dealt with five governors and 60 parish presidents, all the politics that surround any crisis. And so I think it's a right role. I think the thing I was critical of, and Ron will be great at it, the issue I was critical or sort of surprised by was when they released it, they said he didn't report to the president. He reports to Susan Rice and Lisa Monaco, the National Security Advisor and Homeland Security Advisor, respectively, both great, powerful, kick-butt women, and they get stuff done. I just thought that was odd.
You know what troubles me? I mean, I'm not troubled at all. We discussed this with Kaplan, too, that he's not a doctor. The answer is you got to manage the crisis, hire all the medical expertise you want.
Yeah, yeah,
you however, don't want a doctor. Here's what troubled me, and I may be off by one, and if I am, someone will email us and I'll either correct it, apologize, whatever. The one entity you left out of your list of people he's supposed to deal with, and I know you meant it, subsumed within what you talked about, is the public and making sure that the public calms down.
Right.
He missed a huge opportunity, in my estimation, to go on all the Sunday talk shows. I don't think he was on any of them, by the way.
Right.
I may be wrong by one, but I don't think he was on any of them. With all the controversy, a doctor, is he not? The horrible Barack Obama is picking this horrible person. Why not be the you're about to be the face of this thing.
Right.
Go on television and be the face of it. Instead, you lie back and, in my opinion, strategically allow the people who want fear and confusion to fester. Why wasn't he – I mean – there's only so much you need to know to go speak about it.
Right.
Why wasn't the guy available?
I have no
available?
Idea, and I actually had not picked up on that. I mean, the strategy may be that Ron is actually not going to be the public face, that we continue to have the medical public face, get the CDC talking points, the NIH talking
points
online.
Do you think that guy Frieden from the CDC is cutting it? I have to say, he may be a very confident doctor. He does nothing to instill confidence
in me. Right, I think that's one of the challenges. I am a big fan of his. He made some strategic communications errors. He overpromised, underestimated
confidence.
And I mean, look, I'm not a doctor. I don't even play one on TV. And I knew that there would be a patient here in the United States. There's a million people coming over through our airports every single day or whatever the number is. Someone was going to come here. And to say it's not going to come here, it's never overpromise, never underestimate. It is the it is what you learn when you're in crisis management. Prepare people for the inevitable, even the unlikely, so that when it happens, you can say this is what we anticipated and what we have been building for. I mean,
can I ask you one last question about this guy? Everybody, not critics, but Washington observers, who I think are relatively fair, say the criticism of Klain, he was obviously the chief of staff to both Gore and Biden as vice president, is he is a ruthless, arrogant, take charge kind of guy, meaning he doesn't – nobody else's opinion matters. I'm in charge. We're going to get this done. You're smiling broadly, which means that's accurate.
No. I just think, like, look, the take charge is a good thing. I mean, I was always surprised the extent to which decisions don't get made in government. It was so frustrating. You could just have meeting after meeting after meeting. And so I always like people who make decisions and who just sort of say, look, it's going to be, it's not going to be perfect. It's going to be 80% there. And I think part of his role is to get a very amorphous national security, homeland security apparatus that cuts across almost every agency you can think of, from the Department of Education to NIH to DHS, in line. And he's going to have to get people in order. And we had to, I mean, look, this happened during the oil spill as well. I mean, and the mistake we made during the oil spill, and I've admitted this publicly, is we didn't prepare the American public that oil would hit shore. And we knew it from day one. And we're just
so was
like,
that your fault?
It was all of our faults. It was a communication. We just did not prepare them so that when oil hit shore, we lost the storyline.
So you mean if you had gotten ahead of it, I know this is pretty obvious from what you said, and sort of cushioned the blow,
yeah,
saying it's coming, we're ready to deal with it as best we can, or whatever.
And the measure of success is that less of it is coming than would otherwise, because we're burning it, we're skimming it, we're
so were you
we're
just praying in
it.
Your office
no,
or what?
No. We were cleaning up. I just think there's something about disclosing the bad news that's very hard to do. Yeah. And looking back, I've admitted that mistake, that we should have prepared the public. We had, you know, it was like 20 days between the blowout preventer opening and oil hitting shore, that while we were doing all this stuff, burning, skimming, collecting all of it offshore, oil and water, I mean, we all knew it was going to hit shore. And the first time you had an oiled pelican and Anderson Cooper, the combination didn't work,
yes,
for us so well. So it took us a while to unwind.
And just
do you
watching
remember
that
us
thing
watch,
every
I was just going to say 24/7.
Watching that, yeah, oil gushing out,
yeah,
of that underwater pipeline. Oh,
and when no one,
awful.
When no one, you know, this is the storyline in my world, is that no one ever gives you credit for less bad news. I don't know how to put that better, but the economy is back up. The fisheries are back open. There is no evidence of long-term systemic environmental degradation. But you think of the BP oil spill and you think, what a disaster.
Yeah.
I think of it and I think we saved an ocean.
Well, let me just tell you,
obvious.
Those ads, that woman who runs BP Alaska,
awesome,
who's
ads
on television 24/7, is fabulous.
Yeah, no, the BP
but,
ads.
But I, really, you still have
and
to
that was
mad
part
at
of
them.
The settlement. I mean, by the way, that was
that
part of the settlement.
Ads?
They have to do ads to build up the, yeah, economy. And the BP oil spill is actually back in a controversy with Governor Crist in Florida, because he's claiming that it took all of his time that summer. And those of us who were involved, you know, Florida was not that engaged as compared to, say, Bobby Jindal in Louisiana.
Governor Crist, the challenger now to Governor Scott, right?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, well, let's move on to this crazy story up in New Hampshire at the Pumpkin Festival,
gosh,
in Keene. Tear gas, rubber bullets, pepper spray, SWAT teams, all of this. And yet this riot went on for quite some time, and it seemed as though, and even though they praised the cops, many of the people there,
yeah,
saying the cops put up with a lot of guff from these rioters.
Yeah, billiard balls being
thrown at
yes,
them.
Yes, exactly. So they showed tremendous restraint, and kudos to them for that. On the other hand, you think it went on for an awful long time. I mean, why couldn't they quell this sooner?
Well, you know, look, there's 18-year-olds who were clearly getting a high, and possibly a high, on taunting the police officers. I mean, one of them is quoted as saying, you know, it's expletive wicked what we were doing, freaking. I think
you
meant
that.
Freaking.
That's the most unbelievable,
yeah,
quote.
Yeah, yeah. To sort of, and there's this idea that, like, that's sort of fun to challenge cops. I commend the police officers, because you didn't have a Ferguson incident where they're, you know, where you're fighting stones with, you know, with bullets. Police officers are trained to be antagonized. And these police officers dispersed the crowd, and it took them longer than it would have otherwise if they had been more aggressive, but good for them in terms of pepper spray, tear gas. But look, there was this Massachusetts company whose name is Fina Rage.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything with the name Fina Rage seems
what
troublesome.
What's their deal?
Incites
riots. They plan these big parties, these
events. Like the Pumpkin Festival.
Yeah, like the Pumpkin Fest, which I mean, I remember that Pumpkin Fest when my kids were younger. It used
to
not be
a
rage. I don't think we ever made it. I think every year I tried to make it. It's a long way.
You know, you said you'd heard of it. The more I read about this, and for some reason I've become obsessed with this whole pumpkin pandemonium, mm-hmm, or whatever. You know, it's been there like 29 years.
Yes,
they have an average of 40 to 50,000 people.
Yeah.
Had you ever heard of it, Marjorie,
yes,
before this?
Yes, we were all bad parents. We never took our children up to go.
No.
I thought about it, never got my act together.
Well, it's because the truth about Halloween, really, with young kids is you know, in and out. Like, I mean, you know, you spend an hour getting them ready, go knock on doors for 50 minutes, and then they're happy.
You know what, Arma, we're going to do, we do a Halloween show every year where we set standards. And our standard, I think I speak for Marjorie here, is when the kid who comes to your door is 6'4 and weighs 280,
is that, no,
then they probably should not be getting candy. They should probably be turned away.
We have a rule in my house, and no one ever gives it away anymore. I'm not only am I obsessed with Rascal Flatts, I also love Bit of Honey. Do you remember that candy when we were growing up?
Oh, yes. Yes.
So any Bit of Honeys go to me. But now no one gives away Bit of Honeys. And so I got to pick a new candy that's a little bit more popular.
You're right. They're sort of lost their
pretzels. And let me just give advice to
pretzels.
I know people. I live in Cambridge. They're really healthy and they give away pretzels. I mean, don't.
You want
one night a week.
Bit of Honey.
One night a week.
You want those little Halloween little heart. I hate them. Those little Halloween colored kisses.
I just get, I give tofu. Okay,
you get, oh my God.
No,
you know what Bill Weld used to do when
yes,
he was
I do.
In,
beer? Apple
no,
dunking.
He had apple dunking in the foyer of his Brattle Street manse.
Hey,
I thought it was incredible. He'd sit there with his then wife and they'd do the apple dunking.
Julia, you could do that now.
Julia, getting
no,
back to
not.
Homeland Security and that sort of thing, I find myself, and maybe this is age or whatever, I was much more forgiving of this sort of behavior. I wouldn't say forgiving. I was much closer to being forgiving. No, I was not when I was younger.
Yes, you were.
But, you know, now my attitude is you should really come. Well, everybody's entitled to a mistake in life.
Right.
They really are. And I'm not suggesting it scar them forever. But I think the authorities really need to come down hard. And here's my thinking, and that's what I want to run by you. If there are serious consequences, whether it's suspension, expulsion, criminal prosecutions, which the cops say they're going to do, the reason I support it is not just because I think bad behavior should have consequences, but because of the deterrent effect. And that's what I want to ask you about. When you're dealing with 18 and 20-year-olds, do people in your former profession, well, now you're advising in that profession, in security, Homeland Security, does an 18 or 20-year-old kid, when he sees the evening news, or she sees it, mostly he, in 6 months and sees one of these rioters went to jail for 3 months, and other 11 were expelled from Keene State. Does that have any impact on that viewing 18 and 20-year-old? It does? It really does.
Yes, and the parents and others who will be watching next year. And so, I mean, a couple of things. I agree with you. I tend to think we're a little bit too hardcore in our criminal prosecutions. But I think people that are willing to throw things at police officers have lost a gene,
the sort of
respect authority gene. And that's what our criminal justice system, you know, is about. Look, I mean, to me, a cop killer is different. I'm taking it to extreme than a DUI death, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, those are just because a police officer, if we don't have order in many ways, then we're not protecting the rest of society, and that's what the police officers were. So, as I said, you know, they did not push back in the way that we saw Ferguson. They let it ride in a as nonviolent manner as possible. So, I agree with you, but you know. Look, for these party planners, everyone has to assume that crowd control, mob mentality might come into play.
So has that an effect on them? I hadn't even thought about that.
Yeah, in terms of the planning for next year, and you think about that for July 4th or any concert. I mean, look, concerts are starting to have problems too. And I think what organizers have to do for these events is to sort of a plan. What is your crowd control strategy? Because if there starts to be mayhem, the truth is 99% of those people are going to want to get the heck out of Dodge, which is probably the case here. Once people saw what was going on.
We had a mother call whose 20-year-old son was at the thing and left because he thought it was getting out of control.
Yeah, no, it's just, and most people will do that. I mean, that is, you know, and then you leave the 1% to be dealt with through the criminal justice system or through law enforcement. So you got to have an exit strategy for those who want to exit, and then you can confine the threat. But I think people willing to throw things at police officers is a different range of sort of, you know, teenage behavior.
And I also think they didn't expect this level of difficulty, because we talked about this when we talked about this the other day and we first knew about the Keene thing, is that the first year the Red Sox won the World Series, there was, you know, things got out of hand in Kenmore Square, and a young woman actually lost her life. I think it was rubber bullets.
It was a rubber bullet.
Yeah, the police. And then the next time they were close to winning or even the pennant, the Boston cops really planned in advance, and they talked about their strategy. They talked about what they were going to do, and it was night and day.
Yeah,
and I think the expectation in the first World Series thing, just like up in Keene, was not that things would get so out of control so fast.
Right. Well, I think, though, the one thing is looking back, people say that Keene has gotten more and more sort of crazy over the years, and so that this was sort of this pivot point. And I think, you know, if looking back, did the Keene authorities sort of underestimate what this pumpkin fest was becoming? You know, why is it, you know, why are party planners, you know, sort of planning this kind of event? So looking back, it may be that there were hints over the years and that now this became the tipping point. And then the question is sort of for next year, what kind of, not just police presence, but what is the political apparatus saying? What is the college saying? I mean, the college is going to, you know, a couple kids get expelled and that does mean a lot. What information is going out to parents?
Yeah, you but know, you don't, you, have you know, a, I'm not a Homeland Security expert like you are.
But you play one on TV.
Anybody who doesn't know that there's potential for huge violence at a pumpkin fest, it's just not,
I know.
It's just not. Paying it. Would you agree with that?
I agree. Fine. Did you hear, I did tweet out, you know, this is the kind of lifestyle I lead, that I was just in Milwaukee doing some of this advising, and I was staying at the Hilton as the same hotel as Eddie Vedder. Let me test your...
Okay. Vedder. You. Well, obviously you don't know much about
him. I pronounced it wrong.
He was Vedder. Married to what's her name?
Who?
Yeah, he was. Valerie Bertinelli.
Oh, my God.
Oh, that's
Van Halen.
Now they are aging themselves.
Okay, sorry. Oh, sorry.
Do you want to disclose who the band is?
Yeah, what's the band?
What's the band?
Do you know? John, you know everything. Well, you disclose it. What is it? Go ahead, Juliet. Where were you going here?
So that I was coming in. I was leaving in the morning when they were coming in at night. I got old.
Oh.
That used to be me. It really never used to be me.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, you do age over
what's
lifetime.
The name of the band that
I'm forgetting now.
What's
now
the name of the, no, what's the name of the band that Paul McCartney was with before Wings? I can't remember. What's
it? Oh, the Beatles.
Julia. Oh,
the
yeah,
Beatles.
Yeah,
I'm in 1969.
Julia Kayyem, goodbye.
I'm
it's nice to
okay,
see
we'll
you,
see you later.
We'll see you next week.
Okay, sorry about the band. We never get the story about the hotel. What went on there? I hope you had a cocktail and it was much fun. Pearl Jam. Is it Pearl Jam?
Pearl Jam.
Pearl Jam. Okay,
oh my God,
thank you for my crack stuff.
I can't even remember
stuff.
Pearl Jam.
I can't remember anything. Don't worry about it. Juliet Kayyem is a Homeland Security expert. She joins us every Wednesday for Open Mic. Great to see you.
Thank
Juliet.
You.
Juliet. Coming up, Boston Globe editor Brian McGroy gives us his take on last night's gubernatorial debate, plus remembering newspaper giant Ben Bradley. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browder. She is Marjorie. If you happen to have missed last night's Boston Globe WGBH gubernatorial debate, first of all, shame on you. But here's your opportunity to hear, I guess, just a few of the highlights.
Taxes on people who are at the top two or 50%.
How do you do that? How do you do that? There's no graduated income tax in Massachusetts.
Well, we are exploring ways to do a more graduated income tax.
If I say something dumb, Marjorie's... Excuse me, Martha.
Okay.
People
just don't call me sweetheart.
Yeah, don't worry.
The first response for me in the Hobby Lobby decision was, oh, no, because it's not just about contraception. It's about other forms of discrimination.
I just happened to do a ride-along the Friday night of when Ferguson was breaking.
I'm glad you got the ride-along, Charlie.
Would you use this opportunity now to urge Christie and his treasurer to disclose whatever their investigation is into your thing immediately prior to November 4th?
Well, I certainly can't control whatever
the state of New
Jersey
does. No, but would you ask them to do that?
Well, they're doing an investigation. I stay as far away from it as I possibly can get. There's only one person at this table who's actually paid a campaign violation fine, and that would be the Attorney General.
Joining us now on the phone from the Boston Globe, the partner with GBH of last night's debate, is the editor of the Globe. That would be Brian McGroy. Hello, Brian.
Hello, Jim Browder. Hello, Marjorie Egan. How are you?
I'm
good,
very
thank
well.
You.
Very well.
Congratulations to both of you. That was one of the finest moderating jobs that I have ever seen in any debate. The two of you were spectacular.
I'm proud to
be able to say that. It kills me in that I know Jim is going to hang this over my head for the rest of our lives. But the prep that went into that, your command of the topics, your ability to manage the moment by moment give and take was really something to behold.
Thank you.
You're embarrassing
nice
us. You know, Brian, I want to just tell you a little story, though, because I think you're in a unique position to appreciate this. Yesterday, we just happened to have interviews with Chuck Todd, who, of course, did the New Hampshire debate.
Whenever you mention Chuck Todd, you know Jim's knees go weak, but that's a whole different
little
topic.
Little weak, so it's
yeah.
Like
yeah.
We also had a chance to interview John King from CNN, and both of them have interviewed presidents, and they've been debate moderators. moderators.
Okay, let's move it along, Marjorie.
And both of them gave advice to Jim before the debate, and they said, remember, Jim, it's not about you. And I thought that was fascinating.
They did say that.
That they would tell him that.
Can I tell you something? What do they know?
I was going to say, Jim's attitude is, hey, some advice is meant to be ignored. And that's exactly.
Hey,
no,
Brian.
Seriously, guys, this is the last thing to say about it. You were great, and I appreciate it.
Oh,
well,
thank you.
And
the Globe,
and your reporters and a lot of your editors, this wouldn't have happened. So they were terrific, too. Brian, what's your takeaway from last night? First one-on-one debate. There are two more to come, one in Worcester and then the consortium at the end. But it was the first head-to-head thing. What's your takeaway?
Look, it's I agree with the analysis that we had in the Globe today by Jim O'Sullivan. There was no huge movement of any needle in last night's debate. But I think what the public saw is what we kind of knew all along, and that is we have two fully formed adult candidates for a very important office who will take the state in clear but different directions. And I think we should, not to sound maudlin or saccharine here, but I think we should be pretty happy with the candidates for governor that we have, especially if you kept the television on and watched the debate up in New Hampshire for the Senate seat. I think that what you had last night was a really sophisticated exchange of ideas. And, people are going to vote the way they'll vote, but we should be pleased with what the options are that we have.
We are lucky in Massachusetts when you think about it. I mean, we're going from Deval Patrick, who, if you like him or don't like him, obviously a very smart, talented guy, to either Coakley or Baker. I thought one of the interesting moments last night, was when Jim asked Baker about the misconception, what's the biggest misconception about him. And, sitting next to him as we were, his eyes were getting red-rimmed. I thought he was going to almost get weepy, and he was talking about being misconceived as a numbers guy. I wonder.
And not a people person.
Exactly.
Not caring about people.
And I wonder if, people watching that, I don't know. I don't know how it came across on TV. I haven't seen it yet on TV, but up close, it was really kind of something.
It was a very poignant moment in that debate, and he didn't just say it and move on quickly. He lingered on that answer for quite a while. One of my very few regrets in that debate last night was that you then posed the same question to Martha Coakley, and she brought up the fact that she couldn't shake the perception that she's aloof and humorless from the 2010 Senate campaign, but she did not linger. She wasn't given the opportunity to linger. We moved on very quickly. I would have liked to have heard her elaborate on that a little bit more.
Oh, did we move it? Was it my fault we moved on?
By the way, my intention there was to stay on that for a long while, Brian, just so it's clear. And Marjorie kept elmoing me and say, can you move it?
What happened there, Jim? I don't remember. Something happened?
Brian, what's your take? One of the things that sort of threw us off kilter a little bit last night, to tell people a little bit of inside baseball, is that ethics question we asked near the end would not have been part of the debate. It was one of our original questions, but we had decided there was too much other stuff we had to do until you guys posted a story on bostonglobe.com about the decision of the treasurer of New Jersey, who, by the way, is an appointee of the governor, Chris Christie, who's head of the National Governors Association, big supporter of Charlie Baker, whose GOP Charlie wrote the $10,000 check, which is the subject of this whole dispute, basically saying, I'm not releasing this report until after the election. Charlie said, as you just heard to me and Marjorie last night and to the viewers, listen, I can't tell them what to do. Essentially, I'm not going to do it. Does that have a shelf life, or is that since we're not going to see the report before election day, does that have a shelf life, or is that just a one-day Frank Phillips story and a debate story?
Look, I think it was an important story for the Globe to have. I think it's important to not only remind people that there is an active investigation in New Jersey, but that the results of that investigation won't be completed intentionally or not until after the election. So I think that was important for us to do. Whether it goes beyond a one-day story is largely up to the Coakley campaign.
That's a very good
point. You can create television ads around virtually anything these days. And in the final week and a half of this campaign, or 2 weeks, we'll see what they decide to do with it.
You've been watching these things for a while, Brian. Is it what moves people? Is it the the debates, the pack ads, the nasty ads? Or just they're Republican, they're a Democrat, they're an independent, they tend to vote with their party unless there's someone that moves them to the other side. I mean, what do you think when it's going to make the difference here 2 weeks out? Because There still are undecideds.
This is an unusual moment in politics in Massachusetts or anywhere else. We're 13 days from Election Day?
Yep.
I think that we can, you know, at this exact moment, and that may change by the end of the week, but at this exact moment, we have no idea who's going to win this race. Every poll shows that it's within, every poll published so far shows it's within a few points. We've had Coakley on top. Other polls are coming out today with Baker on top. We're seeing a truly close race. So what's decided this, or what has influenced this? I mean, I think debates naturally have an influence. I think there's going to be an influence that we haven't seen yet in the ground game. It's going to be Charlie Baker's metrics and his ability to drive people out versus the vast Democratic get-out-the-vote machine, and whether that is brought to life for a candidate who many of the elites say hasn't inspired enough. It's also, let's face it, an onslaught of television commercials. Charlie Baker especially has been able to buy an awful lot of TV time. There are these Super PAC ads out there. Jim, both you and Marjorie raised them last night.
Yeah.
In a race like this with two very cautious candidates who are doing everything in their power to avoid a mistake, I think the TV plays a huge role in this.
You know, two quick observations about that is I went over to campaign staff on both sides last night just to thank them. You know, I hope you thought it was fair, et cetera.
No, you didn't. You went over to say, you'd wait for them to say, Jim, you did a spectacular
well, if
job.
They chose,
let's be honest.
No, I didn't. No, if they chose to say that, that was fine.
Oh,
I didn't ask them.
Hold on.
Jim was also available for multiple interviews at the same time. So.
Okay,
did you catch the moment, Marjorie, when you all lined up for photographs after it was the four of you? And after like 5 minutes, the photographer said to say, Jim, we're done. We're done. You can stop posing now. We're done.
Okay. I will
That's
try
right.
to say what when I went over.
I turned around and tried to talk to him, but he shushed me away because he was conducting yet another interview.
Of both campaigns, beyond the fact that they showed the usual confidence that any campaign has to, I have to say it was not the usual arrogant, we're clearly going to win this thing that I am used to hearing from every campaign, even if they're 20 points behind. So that was rather, I thought, interesting. But let me say one last thing in answer to Marjorie's question, Brian. I'm curious to know your reaction, particularly watching on TV, which is what 99.9% of the people who saw the debate were. I would say 90%, I didn't say this to Marjorie either, of the comments I got about last night's debate was not about what Charlie or Martha said about anything, but about Charlie and or Martha as people. I didn't know Charlie had this. I didn't know Martha could be funny. I didn't know Charlie could be warm. Whatever it was, I think that format is conducive to that, just sitting down around a table having a conversation. But they want to either like or feel, I think, that they know something about what kind of person would lead. Don't you think that's true?
I think that's exactly true. And, those impressions really, really matter. And whether they're supported by television ads or knocked down by television ads, that matters too. But, for my money, that format last night was pretty terrific because it gave both of them an awful lot of time. It wasn't structured. It was up to, there was no fake clock that their 30 seconds are up. It was just common sense and you guys moving them along. And, Martha at times was funny and human. I mean, her little dig at Charlie, I'm glad you got that ride along.
That was great.
Yeah.
Quite something. And Charlie was very human as well.
Especially when Marjorie asked him the sweetheart question, which obviously he was not happy was coming. And he leans
back
in his chair and says something like, I don't remember his exact, oh, thank you, Marjorie, for bringing that up.
At one point he said to me, you're killing me.
That's what he said.
Oh, Marjorie, you're killing me.
When he called Martha Coakley Marjorie and her retort at him was just, don't call me sweetheart.
Yeah, that was
I thought that was quite good, too. At one point, Charlie put his arm around her shoulder in the middle of the debate, which I thought was...
I didn't see that.
Neither did I.
A little unusual, but it didn't feel intimidating or inappropriate.
Wow. It's so funny how much you miss when you're up there on the stage. One last thing, Brian. You know, I don't know who I think should... Ty Burr had a great thing about the film tax we didn't get to, but he had the great question about who should play Martha and who should play Charlie in the movie. And Charlie said Clint Eastwood should play him, and she said Liam Neeson. I forget on the Martha thing.
I don't know if she answered it. Who would you pick? You're a big film fan.
I suggested Reese Witherspoon, but she didn't go for it.
That's okay. Well, how about it, Brian?
look, Jim, the last movie I saw was Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. So you're asking the wrong guy. Can I just give this take this opportunity to give a shout out though to the Globe questioners as well?
They were great.
I thought they were terrific. Very, very obviously very knowledgeable in their field and very human in the way they presented their questions. I thought that worked out really, really well.
And by the way, I want you to know, because I'm sure you're going to bring this up, in only one meeting did I complain about them taking away my airtime.
Do you really want to open that door up?
No, I
here?
Don't.
Hey,
do Brian,
really
that's not true.
Get into that now?
It wasn't just one meeting.
You know, you mentioned the Brown-Shaheen debate. It was on NECN last night. Chuck Todd was with us yesterday. He was the moderator of the thing. For those who missed that, that followed us at 8 o'clock, here's a tidbit from each side during last night's debate. Please listen.
Do you approve of the job President Obama is doing? Now, there'll be a chance to follow up, but this is a yes or no answer. Do you approve, yes or no?
In some ways I approve, and some things I don't approve.
You had two chances to run for the U.S. Senate in Massachusetts in 2013 and 2014. Why not take those?
Because I live here. I live here. I was born at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. My mom is a waitress at Hampton Beach.
A little less respectful crowd. When Scott Brown says, I was born here, there's booing from, obviously, the Shaheen people. Did you watch any of this debate when you got home or no?
I have not. I need to sit down and go through the whole thing. I've seen the clips, but not the full debate. But our account of it, Josh Miller's account of the Globe today, portrays it as an extremely freewheeling hour.
Yeah, and by the way, as we discussed yesterday, for those who are not paying attention or say, I don't care anymore, unless you're in New Hampshire, that is one of the races that is going to decide whether or not there's a Republican Senate come January. So it's actually a pretty big deal.
Well, can we move on to what I'm really dying to talk
about?
Yeah,
I know you are. So am I.
Ben Bradley, editor of the longtime editor of the Washington Post, died at 93. You know, I'm dying to get your take on him and on his influence. I said to Jim yesterday, you know, he talks a lot about seeing To Kill a Mockingbird, Atticus Finch, played by Gregory Peck in the movie and the great novel written by Harper Lee. And that's what inspired him to become a lawyer.
Yes.
Jim Browdy. So many reporters, you know, it was Watergate and it was the Washington Post and Ben Bradley and Woodward and Bernstein. What was the impact of him on your life as a reporter, Brian?
Look, you cannot, forget me, you cannot be in this business and not regard Ben Bradley as a driving force behind what you do, is a hero figure. His influence on investigative reporting in America, on the idea that a newspaper can be a showcase every single day, incredibly well written with beautiful features as well as hard-hitting accountability stories, that a newspaper needs to be fascinating every day, not just some sort of a reflection of what various institutions are or aren't doing. He is truly that rare figure in life that is every bit as legendary as one might hope or think.
Well, you know what I was struck by, too, when you think back to the Watergate times, you know, the great line, and Bob Woodward was quoted, he, of course, was the reporter that broke with Bernstein, the Watergate story. His line, he talked about hearing from Ben Bradley, do we have it yet? Do we have it yet? Have we proved it? And how he hated to hear from Bradley, you don't have it yet, kid. There was the famous, like, two-source standard that went on there. I'm not sure we still have that. Certainly, we don't have it online. That you need to get, if person A tells you something, you need to get at least person B to corroborate that before you would ever put it in the newspaper. And person A and person B better be people that you know and understand and as credible people, etc. Is that still true?
Well, I would hope it's still true, Marjorie. I mean, look, it's true for some media organizations, less true for others. And you're right. Online, it's a whole lot more freewheeling. There's a whole lot of stuff that just drifts into publication that perhaps shouldn't. But, you know, Ben, with his oversight of the post-Watergate coverage, set a standard by which still lives on, you know, this many decades later. And I do think it's still true for places like the Post and the New York Times and the Boston Globe and the L.A. Times. I do.
Did you know him, by the way, Brian?
I didn't know him. I had a few opportunities to meet him. I actually had a telephone interview with him back in the mid-1990s. He was pretty freshly retired from the Post, and I was doing a story on, I think it was a National Enquirer or something like that, and I don't know why he came up, but I called him up, and I have never been, I've interviewed presidents, but I have never been as nervous as I was when Ben Bradley got on the phone with me. And then I had a, when my cousin Mary McGrory died back in 2004, she had left a letter asking me to deliver the eulogy at her funeral. And afterward, I was outside the church, and Ben Bradley came up to me and to talk about the eulogy, and I literally got weak in the knees because it was, I mean, he is a giant in this business. I can't overstate the impact that he has had.
What did your cousin think about working for him? What was that like?
She loved him, absolutely loved him. Everybody says, you've read it a thousand times in the coverage of Ben Bradley's death, that people would go through a wall for him. They would climb any mountain. They would swim any ocean. And she felt the exact same way. And the reason that it was like that was he was two things at once. He was extremely supportive of talented reporters and editors, extremely supportive. He would do anything for you if he knew you would do could do something for the institution. But he was also tough. He wasn't just going to let people slide into print with whatever it was they wanted. He had standards that were exacting, and reporters and editors, columnists, wanted nothing more than to make Ben Bradley happy, to meet the standard that he set, because they knew that when they did, good things were going to happen to them.
You know, by the way, for those who are listening and know of Ben Bradley but are a little too young to have remembered Watergate, here's a little a wonderful scene. It was 1976, All the President's Men, great film. Jason Robards plays Ben Bradley. Dustin Hoffman and Robert Redford, I think, brilliantly play Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward. Here's a little scene where they're talking to the reporters about the Deep Throat, obviously the source, who we later years learned to be this guy, Mark Felt. Just listen. The first voice you'll hear is that of Jason Robards playing Ben Bradley.
Mitchell, no, he was talking to a reporter.
Yeah, but I think I woke him up.
And good notes?
Verbatim.
He really said that about Mrs. Graham. Well, I'll cut the words of her tit and print it.
What?
It was the family newspaper. How much can you tell me about Deep Throat?
How much do you need to know?
You trust him?
Yeah.
I can't do the reporting for my reporters, which means I have to trust them. And I hate trusting anybody. Run that, baby.
Gives me chills. It really does. Oh, man.
That's another element. He mentioned Mrs. Graham in there, his relationship with Kay Graham, who was a publisher and owner of the publisher of the Post and owner of the Post in many regards. After her husband died, their relationship was unique in American journalism. They had an extraordinary relationship. When she died, he delivered the eulogy, and his great line toward the end of the eulogy was, "She was a spectacular dame, and I loved her."
Oh, that is so great.
Well, you have a way with words as well. But I want to ask you one last thing about him, Brian. He had this other extraordinary, very glamorous life. I mean, he and his third wife, Sally Quinn, had the salon down in D.C. And before that, when he was married to wife number two, Tony, there's famous pictures of him and his wife with Jacqueline and Jack Kennedy. One of them, I remember them, I think the Post ran it this morning, of them sitting on a couch where Ben Bradley had his arm around Jacqueline Kennedy. He had a very close relationship with the president and was, you know, like a big party guy well into his 80s, which is unusual, I think, in the news. I mean, you're not entertaining half of Boston every night out wherever it is you
He's
live,
not?
Brian.
How do you know that?
Well, maybe you
how do you
are.
Know that? What are you saying?
I don't know.
why don't you just announce to the world, God, Brian, you're a boring lump on a log. It's incredible how things have changed.
I'm sorry. But, you know, the relationship with JFK was very, very unusual for a newspaper editor. Was it not?
Do you know how they met?
No.
It was in the I never realized this. It was in the fantastic Washington Post obituary today. Yeah. They met on the street in Georgetown. They had young children at the same time. They lived on the same block, and they met walking their children in carriages with their wives. And they struck up a relationship. And this was before JFK was president, and before Actually, no. Would it have been before he was president? Probably shortly before. Mm-hmm. And they struck up a relationship, had dinner, and it stuck for a long, long time.
Yeah, I guess they were over in the White House, you know, the Bradleys, Mr. and Mrs. Bradley, having cocktails and dinner with Mr. and Mrs. Kennedy.
Ben and Sally Quinn had a house, have a house in Georgetown that is right in the heart of Georgetown. Just a huge, beautiful mansion that you're right was the constant source of these, you know, wonderful salon dinners and parties that the likes of which I was never actually invited to.
I hope you'll invite Marjorie and me to one of your salon parties at some point. Hey, Brian.
You know what my salon parties involve? It's usually a couple of dogs, some rabbits, two Maine Coon cats. Jim, I know you don't like animals.
No, I don't like suburbs either.
I do. I'm fond of roosters myself.
Brian, before you go on a serious note, since you started with one we'd love doing it with the Globe last night. GBH did. And again, your people, both on the air and behind
great.
The scenes, were people without whom we couldn't have done anything. So thanks for the whole thing, Brian.
I appreciate that. I thought it was a terrific partnership on the debate. We're very proud to do it with you guys.
Great.
Hope we can do it again.
Talk to you next week. Thanks, Brian
McGroy.
Thank you.
Brian McGroy is editor of the Boston Globe. He joins us every Wednesday. Up next, one of the largest professional associations and advocacy groups for science has started a program called Science for Seminaries. What was once a fraught relationship between science and religion is finding some common ground, and WGBH's science editor, Heather Goldstone, joins us for that conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is Boston Public Radio.
89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1 Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR. I want to repeat what Marjorie just said to make sure you get it right. This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. You weren't listening to the spot, Marjorie, that was during the break there. The American Association for the Advancement of Science, it's one of the largest professional associations and advocacy groups for science, has started a program, this is unbelievable, called Science for Seminaries. And a school in Newton is one of the first 10 recipients of the award. Here with us in Studio 3, talk about the relationship between science and religion and how it's apparently changing is WGBH's science editor. That's Heather Goldstone. Heather is also an expert in ocean science. Hi, Heather.
Good to be here.
So what is the deal? You know, you think of science and religion not really meshing together.
Never the twain.
Exactly. Never the twain shall meet. What are they going to teach these people at these seminaries?
Well, in the press release for the new program, they cite a 2013 survey that they had done that showed that particularly among evangelical Christians, Christians are more likely than the rest of the public to turn to a religious leader when they have questions about science. So essentially they're saying, right, people are already turning to religious leaders for guidance on science-related issues, so we need to make sure that these religious leaders know what they're talking about when it comes to the science.
But wait, don't go ahead yet. They turn to religious leaders when they have questions about science?
Like what? Like evolution or other things?
Well, that would be the obvious one, right? But there are a lot of places, I think, where we see science intersecting with our values, right? And whether it's stem cells or abortion anything health related, pretty much environmental issues. Climate change is another one where we're seeing a huge intersection, actually in a positive way, between science and faith-based groups. So I think there's a lot of places where people could be saying, you know, OK, well, this is what I'm hearing. Is this really true? It doesn't necessarily mesh with what the Bible says. How do I interpret this and how do I act on it?
But the climate change thing, to me at least, is an outlier. There were all these faith groups. I read a lot about them during the climate change, the 350.org thing in New York City. And the reason why that doesn't strike me as that odd is whether you're a creationist or you're an evolutionary type, the reality is you can still care, regardless of how we got here, you can still care about protecting the planet. But what I don't get is, if the last poll I saw a year or two ago, something like 95% of people believe in evolution, or it's somewhere in the 90s. At the same time, 75% of people I saw a poll this morning believe in miracles and that there is a God. So if it were 78%, how can essentially overwhelming numbers of people believe in evolution, and at the science-based, and this almost the same or at least comparable numbers believe in things that are totally unprovable scientifically.
Well, first of all, I want to know where you're getting your evolution numbers.
Well, what do you think they are?
The numbers I've seen most recently, and it's been pretty steady for, I think, like 20 years at this point, is that somewhere just shy, maybe 48%, don't
no,
quote me on that.
That's true.
Say that evolution is how we got here. And about a quarter say they don't know, essentially. About a quarter or say that that's not the case. And then there's about a quarter. It's really interesting. When this survey was done just last year, they found that if you word the question differently and you say scientists say that the theory of evolution means that, you know, we evolved from other forms of life, then people say true. They're aware that that's what science says. And then if you just say essentially ask them to evaluate true or false on evolution, they say false. So there's about a quarter of Americans who understand that this is what scientists think, but they don't personally believe it.
So there's essentially –
they believe the seven-day God thing in Genesis.
They believe the surveys don't necessarily say what they do believe, but they do not believe evolution.
So they're okay. So essentially, they reject science. They're science deniers, is what you're telling me. Is that not,
right?
I mean, that is
essentially.
But I don't find that surprising because I think that we are an unusually religious country.
How can you say, we may be religious? How can you say that if what Heather says is true? And obviously, again, I correct my apologize for my incorrect polling data. How does that not trouble you? That what did you say? 48% of the people, half the people in America. Believe which? In creationism? Is that what
you're saying? No, so 48% actually say yes, evolution.
Oh, yeah. 48. And so there's a half the people who either have doubts or don't believe it.
Half. Half don't know. So then, a quarter don't know. And then a quarter
well, fine,
of the,
know is pretty horrible.
Well, because we have a huge evangelical population in America. And the evangelicals believe the Bible is literal. And
right,
they believe
it's a really interesting
the seven-day thing.
Yeah, so 26% of adult Americans self-identify as evangelical Christian.
Yeah,
it's a huge chunk of the population. And interestingly,
by the way, it's not all in the South, too. In places like my home state of Pennsylvania,
and
it's
and
over
I definitely
40%.
Don't want to be, branded as an evangelical basher. But I think that is the population where we're seeing the most conflicts. I mean, it's really interesting when it comes to climate change. And you said, you know, there was actually this extra meeting in New York at the end of September when the UN had their summit. Mm-hmm. There was a meeting across the street of international faith-based organizations. There's been a real convergence of religion and science with regard to climate action, except in one place.
Where's that?
And that's within evangelical Christianity. There's this deep divide. And there's a section of the evangelical community that has totally embraced this idea of creation care, that we have a responsibility to care for the earth and also compassion for the poor and future generations. But then there's a portion of the evangelical community that reads Genesis in a completely different way and says, God gave us dominion over the planet to do with as we please. And that means that if we want to drill oil for our benefit, that's what we should do.
That's the same group that believes that God thinks that corporations are people. Is that the same group you're talking about?
But you know what I find much more interesting? I find this thing about MIT, these guys getting together at MIT. I guess there were some women there too. Men and women getting together at MIT. Scientists.
Big brain people.
Yeah, big brain people. And basically saying, talking about whether God exists. And this is something that's kind of unusual in academia, and particularly at MIT, which is, of course, the neuroscientists and the engineers and all that kind of stuff. The conclusion they were drawing is that science has not actually drummed God out of the picture entirely.
No, I definitely don't think it is. And actually, I don't think it's that odd to have scientists talking about this, especially coming from the perspective that one of the people involved in this group you're mentioning is Alan Lightman, who is a physicist and author. But physicists, for time immemorial, they get into metaphysics, they get into philosophy, right? They're thinking about the nature of our universe and the origin of the entire universe. And there's a point where you just can't avoid getting into philosophy and religion and is there a God? And Alan Lightman, in fact, in his most recent book, Accidental Universe, went through a lot of kind of analyses of how religion and science could fit together. And one of his observations I found particularly interesting, which was that religion in older forms in particular, where it was this, you know, pantheon of different gods and whims and you know, angry
Greeks
gods
and
this
Romans.
And that. That it was very difficult to find any order in a world where you've got so many different gods who are even warring with each other. But that as we transitioned to primarily, obviously not exclusively, but to primarily monotheistic religions, with that comes the idea that there should be one set of rules in the world and that we should be able to understand them and live by them. And that that actually can promote a bit of a scientific worldview, that we should be able to understand the laws of the universe, whether they were given to us by God or by physical or evolutionary forces or whatever. I thought it was really interesting.
Can we go for a second to the one place that gives me the biggest intellectual headache? And I know I'm not alone in this thing. What's the predominant theory right now as to how the universe was created? In the science community, what is it, Big Bang? Well, what is it? What's the...
Well, I mean, it's kind of working from the Big Bang theory. What's really interesting and I think has given a lot of... astrophysicists' real pause is the fact that there's evidence from a couple of different avenues that, in fact, there's not one universe, that there may be multiple universes.
That's giving me a bigger headache. Okay.
I mean, it's such a headache that you can't even know. And so that gets a lot of people into these God questions.
Well, so here's – that's where I want to go. And I'm an agnostic. But here's what I –
It's a lot to be in charge of if you're God.
Okay, but just stay with me for a second here. So what do they say? And I assume I'm not atypical in having this concern. Whatever scientific scientific thesis as to the creation of the universe you believe in, it's X, let's say. When you ask that scientist who believes that X was how the universe was created, well, what existed before the creation that led to the creation of the universe as you described it? What's the answer? That's the headache thing. Is the answer to that question?
So I'll give you a different headache.
Okay.
Okay, so and this is where the God question comes in. Even if we don't get into the whole what happened before, the question is, we live in a universe that is of all the possibilities of how a universe could work, and then getting down to our planet and how our planet has evolved, we've got a little teeny tiny place in the universe that's just right for life. Why didn't it happen everywhere?
Oh, that's weird.
Right? So then it gets into the question. So there are two answers. And one of them is essentially something or someone made the universe this way so that it would be perfect for us, which gets you to God. The alternate possibility is there are actually infinite universes out there that cover the whole span of all the possibilities. And we just happen, of course.
Including another Earth-like thing, right?
Well, except that there's probably, even if you go through all the possibilities, you're only going to come up with this one unique combination once or a limited number of times.
You don't think
so we just
another
happen to be living
talk show
in that
just
place.
Like ours in another universe? But wait a second.
Hold on. But I always figured there were other Earth-like planets in our universe. Aren't there?
Well, it's possible. And I mean, a lot of effort goes into finding them. And when we find, they call them the Goldilocks planets that are just right. You know, there's a very small number of these. For life. That are the right distance from a star, that are the right size, that have the right amount of water. And, you know,
there are not many of them. You're not escaping my question. Let's get back to this for a second. And by the way, this had nothing to do with what we intended to talk about. But I can't control myself. So what is the genius Nobel Prize winning scientist who you're sitting down with, Heather, when you asked the same pathetic question that I just asked you, okay, fine, you've convinced me that's how the universe was created, what existed before it, what does he or she say? What do they say? I literally, whenever that enters my mind, I immediately distract myself because it gives me such a headache that I can't deal. What is the answer?
And I can't say that I have the answer for you, but my understanding is essentially that everything was compacted into essentially nothing and that there is nothing before.
See, that's the headache.
Which is a completely mind-blowing idea.
Oh my God,
and again, that's what gets you back to these God ideas. And I don't think that you talk to a lot of scientists, and there are plenty of scientists who are devoutly religious.
Is there a lower percentage of scientists who are religious than in the general population?
You know, it's a good question. I don't actually know the answer.
That line, Jim, I am the alpha, the omega. What does that mean? I'm the beginning and the end and the middle and the whole thing. Isn't that what that means? Something like that. You know, the thing I was going to mention when Jim just asked there what the percentage is of religious scientists is, that I wrote this for my new job, cruxnow.com, the website in the Globe on Catholicism. I went to this thing at Harvard. And it was not entirely off the record, but they get together at a certain period, a bunch of scientists and non-scientists, English professors and whatever, to talk about kind of spirituality and religion and stuff like that. And the theme of the night I was there was about mentoring in a spiritual fashion. And this guy from Berkeley got up and talked about how he was a very out there Christian. And he said that when he got a promotion at University of California, Berkeley, which is thought to be a very liberal place, very, you know, kind of like Boston lefty and stuff, he's at this faculty meeting. And there, when he gets his promotion with all these higher deans and stuff, and someone jokes, he says, "Well, sure glad there aren't any Christians in the room." And he sheepishly says, "Well, actually, I am a Christian." And everyone kind of goes, "Oh." And then the guy says, "Well, at least there are no Republicans." And then they all, you know, continue their dinner. And so he talked about how difficult it is to come out as a believer before you get tenure. And this woman at MIT, who was Jewish, because I usually think the prejudice around here is against evangelical Christians. You know, there's a lot of skepticism about that. This is a Jewish woman who's like a big deal at MIT, long past her tenure, get up and gave this beautiful talk about how difficult it is for students, because basically being religious is thought to be anti-intellectual, and you must be kind of, only dopes believe that kind of stuff, you know, the opiate of the masses,
right,
kind
absolutely.
Of thing. And afterwards I went up and said to her, "You know, this was great. I'd love to be able to quote you in my piece." And she said, "Nah." She had no interest in being associated with the notion that she is herself not only religious but talks about religion with her students, because it was the same thing. If you're religious, you better shut up until you have your secure tenure.
You know, that's an interesting perspective. And I remember being at a conference back in my graduate school days. And one of the organizers of the conference got up, and I don't know how he got onto the topic, but was talking about the fact that he is Jewish, he is observant, and in fact, his drive to become a scientist came out of his religion. That his reading and the reading of the Old Testament that he had learned was that essentially the Old Testament says that we need to go out and catalog the life on Earth, and that to him science, it as a, you know, a derivation of that, of understanding the world, cataloging the world, is actually the most godly work that he could possibly choose. And so I think there, you know, it's obviously it's a really personal thing. And there are a lot of people who feel this tension or fear some sort of, you know, you're not scientific enough or you're not religious enough if you're a scientist and that kind of thing. But there are a lot of people who do manage to make the two mesh very well.
Now, on the other hand, I know someone that was trained in, got his doctorate at Brown. He's an English teacher. And he just got sent to a school in Georgia. And he's an agnostic, and he said he gets down to Georgia, this university in Georgia. Everybody's, and plus he's gay, and he's saying, everybody down there saying, "What church are you going to? What church are you going to? Where you want to sign up? This is the church you should go to," because they're all Baptist church down there. And she's saying, I really don't think I'm going to be going to one of these churches. But he said there it's just the exact opposite, where, you know, because it is the Bible Belt, and there is that very strong Southern Baptist thing going on, that he's worried that he won't be able to get tenure unless he starts singing in the choir at the Baptist church down the street.
Can we get back to where we started, Heather Goldstone? This sort of and you had a smile on your face as if this is a much warmer, more collegial relationship when science and religion come together. That's another thing I just can't visualize it. I mean, despite the statistics you gave, which make it seem to make more sense, it seems to me they're, by definition, they're totally different worldviews, no?
You know, yes and no. I mean, I think they're totally different ways of trying to understand the universe. But in some ways, both of them are trying to make sense of the universe. And there are definitely places where they clash, particularly if you start getting into a literal interpretation of any particular religious text. But, you know, and I know some people kind of say, okay, what's this whole, like, are you religious or not? No, but I'm spiritual. What does that even mean to be spiritual? But I think there are a lot of people out there who recognize that we have a human drive to have some sense of meaning, and that science doesn't always give us the answers and the meaning that we're looking for. And there was actually a really interesting philosophy paper that came out just this week where the thesis of the whole thing was essentially that we shouldn't basically be using the word belief for both science and religion, that they're two very different things, to believe that evolution happened in a scientific sense as opposed to believe that God created the earth.
Because believe in the former instance cheapens
that maybe,
the
you know,
science.
And I think this is something that communications experts have been talking about as well. Yeah, that we need to use words like that people accept this, or that people know or agree, that we use different words from belief, because it's a very different process. And this paper that came out actually kind of in some ways reconciled this ability to have both a religious belief and a scientific knowledge by saying, and these are his words, and I'm not trying to cheapen anything, almost comparing it to like children's imaginary play. That if you're pretending you're a spaceman, you still know that gravity is in effect. If you're pretending to make a hamburger out of Play-Doh, you know not to eat it. You still have this knowledge in your mind of what is reality while you are in this construct. And he kind of reconciles the two, saying that religion is a construct that people tend to draw on in certain existential situations.
So you get comfort from religion and your intellect is fed by science? Is that sort of the...
I guess that was kind of his thesis. Meet? And I it'll be interesting to see how that plays, because I have a feeling that'll not necessarily sit well with a lot of people. But
so I guess the Newton... Where is this place now? The Andover Newton Theological School will be soon getting all their instructions on how to mix this all up.
Yeah, well, and I think that the... you know, it's more about creating a science curriculum that fits in, making sure that they've got the scientific facts, not necessarily trying to fully meld science and religion.
Yeah, but okay. I'm sorry, let's end with this. So at the seminary, these scientists come in as part of this one of these 10 grants, and they start talking about evolution. And the seminarians say, we can skip that part because we don't believe in evolution.
The Pope has said, 60 years. Yeah,
60 years the Catholic Church has said there is no inherent conflict between evolution and Christianity as long as you retain a role for God.
Right.
Some
I think
for
it's
God.
There's that small group of people, the 25%, it's the evangelicals that for the fundamentalists for the most part, everything in the Bible is literal. Most other people, at least I know Catholics don't, and I don't think Jews think is literal. I don't think. I think there's just a small group of people, and that's why there's these big fights about teaching evolution in the schools, right?
You know that there's some people who are serious presidential candidates in both the last round and this round who do not believe in evolution. You know that, right? I mean, is that not scary? I thought
how much of that was really what they thought, or how much of that was what they thought they had
don't you think both scenarios are pretty frightening?
Yeah, I think it is pretty frightening. I mean, I couldn't believe it. Was it 2008? They were up debating evolution in the Republican primaries in some of these states. It was crazy.
I mean, I don't know who said it first. I certainly didn't come up with this, though. But everybody is entitled to their beliefs, but we should all be working off the same facts.
Yeah, that's a very good one. So if you started up at the Woods Hole Institutional Institute, what do you call the Woods Hole thing? What's the name of it?
The Oceanographic Institute.
If you showed up there and started a prayer hour with your guitar and started singing hymns,
There was a postdoctoral researcher who showed up a number of years ago and wanted to put religious disclaimers on evolutionary biology papers, and he got asked to leave the lab pretty quickly.
Good. Okay. Heather Goldstone, it's great to see you.
Very much. Heather Goldstone is WGBH's science editor. She is also an expert in ocean science. She's not holding any prayer meetings with psalms and guitars anytime soon down there at Woods Hole. Heather, great to talk to you. Up next, Sue O'Connell joins us for Homeschooling 101. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brodda. She's Marjorie. And homeschooling is on the rise. These numbers I'm going to get right. Over the last 15 years, the number of children who are being homeschooled has increased by 75%. Today, close to 1.5 million kids are being taught at home. Sue O'Connell is among those who is rocking the schoolhouse, opting to have her daughter homeschooled. She joins us every Wednesday. She is the co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News. And by the way, we're going to get your take on homeschooling in a few minutes after talk to Sue. Sue, how are you?
I'm very well.
Hey, before you get to homeschooling, though, as Sue walked into the studio, the one question that neither Martha Coakley nor Charlie Baker answered quickly last night was a Ty Burrs question. Who would play you in a movie? What you had the best answer just now.
Tom Hanks and Jodie Foster.
That is almost perfect, isn't it?
Baker said that he thought Clint Eastwood should play him. Meryl Streep should play Martha Coakley. Martha Coakley said Liam Neeson should play Charlie.
I didn't hear the Neeson
thing. That was a pretty good one. But she never really came up with one for herself. I thought Reese Witherspoon. I thought that was really
flattering. Oh, yeah, from Election.
Yeah.
Okay, on the homeschooling, which Marjorie and I have talked about ad nauseum in our former radio life.
Here's why I'm so glad to be talking to you about
this.
Thank you very
much. Because
Jim has these unfair stereotypes
I had.
Homeschoolers, and you ruin every one of those things.
That's my job.
You're gay, well, you're smart, you're in the city, and you have just blown the stereotypes aside.
Well, I homeschool because I'm a creationist.
I thought
I'm not. I'm kidding.
Why do you homeschool?
Well, it's not our first choice, and it's really not even our second choice. It's that my daughter has just been diagnosed with a chronic disease that she's going to have for a long time and a lifetime. And she's got fatigue and pain. And she was in middle school for 2 years, and it was just too difficult to deal with the school and the teachers. And I live in a great school district, and this is not at all a knock against them, except if anybody has ever been on one of those 401 plans where your kid isn't totally disabled but isn't totally well, and you're supposed to have a unique plan for your child to get through the school year, it's a mess. It's a disaster. And I spent more time trying to fix the 401 plan for her than I realized that, you know, we could just take a year. I'm actually virtually schooled. I'm not, you know, she's homeschooling, but we're going to an actual school called the International Academy, which is a virtual school.
What does that mean?
Well, that means I monitor her work. I'm her teacher coach, her home coach. Mm-hmm. And for 4 hours a day, God willing, we sit and go through the lesson plans, and they're all prompted on the computer screen, and we get books, and we get the whole thing. And, you know, and I help her. I have the lesson keys and the answer keys, and we go through the whole thing. And then she completes the day. So I'm not necessarily required for coming up with the curriculum, which is...
Okay. So before you were put in a position where you had to do this for the educational needs of your kid, what was your attitude about homeschooling?
Well, we joke about it now because when Ruby was going into first grade, my then partner and her other mother, who's a college educator, we were driving home from Labor Day vacation going, "Oh, you're going to start school tomorrow, Ruby." And she's in the back seat and she said, "What's homeschool?"
No, she
and we
did
both
not.
Turned around and went, "Where'd you hear that?" "Don't ever say that again," you know. And she said, "From the Dugars, of course, on TLC." So I blame them. But, you know, I had the same idea that why would you want to do this?
The Dugars
this
is for the 19 kids?
Right.
Yeah,
this is so awful for the kid. But then I lived in Mission Hill and I met a dad, you know, the kind of code, there's a code in everything, of course, and the code is like, I'm not homeschooling for religious purposes. Like, you self-identify as a non-religious purposes homeschooler. He had like 4 kids in home that his wife was teaching at Mission Hill. 2 of them got into Harvard, you know, and when he broke it down for me, I remember it was a very eye-opening moment. Like, how long does it take to get them into the school, onto the bus? How much at their lockers? I mean, when you think about it, they're really only learning, if you're lucky, for 4 hours a day.
Yeah.
But I still have some. Let me tell you, just in defense of myself, and I thank you.
You have no defense.
Where my biases came from were speeches like this. I looked this up this morning. In the 2002 Southern Baptist Convention, here's the lead speaker. This is a quote. "Do we want our children to be like the ultra-liberal teachers that they have in public school, or do we want them to be like Christian parents?" Mm-hmm. I mean, that, by the way, and that factually is the genesis of the, to use an odd term there, of the homeschooling movement. And so my attitude was, it was this uninformed, ridiculous, anti-public school movement. But and I've gotten over that because I know there are people that just have decided, maybe because they're not happy with the quality of public schools, and that's a lot of what the growth is about. But the part that I can, you said, how much learning do they do during the day? Mm-hmm. One of my major objections always is, I think what I got out of school that's been of use to me as an adult throughout my whole life was the socialization part of school. It wasn't the book learning. I was never a phenomenally good student, and I was never a great socializer either, but I learned how to deal with other people.
And that's a major, that's a major setback. You know, Ruby is not an outgoing kid. You know, she likes adults better than she likes kids.
Well, I know
kids.
Her a little. Yeah, she's actually a pretty out.
I mean, she likes you.
Okay.
I mean, you know, someone's going to like
them. Okay, good.
But she's not an outgoing kid. She's always been like right underneath the little popular group. And, you know, she said to me the other day, like, well, you know, I'd rather go to school because it forces me to socialize.
That's what I mean.
You know,
me too, by the way.
You know,
it did, yeah.
And I get that. And that's why it's not like the number one solution for us. But I think that if you're living in rural Maine and your son or daughter is transgender and getting bullied every day and the kid is a self-motivated learner, you know, this might be an answer. There's just some horrors of going to school that you don't need to put up with. Or if you're living in one of these districts, I mean, I heard your segment before. You know, I have a second cousin who in middle school was asked to write a term paper on some social event. And just out of the blue, she wrote it on same-sex marriage 2 years ago. And she was ostracized by the whole class. You know, and the
what
teacher.
What state is this in?
This was in Tennessee,
mm-hmm.
And the teacher asked her not to do it if she could tone it down.
Wow.
You know, so for everybody who thinks we need to teach them about the dinosaurs, there are also people out there who are saying, "I want to teach my kids about the real history." I mean,
yeah, but
but you know something? There's a lot of evidence in a lot of these homeschooling stories about people getting together for activities.
Yeah, they absolutely do.
You know,
that.
I mean, I have a very good friend.
You need to deal with the social thing.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes,
yeah, okay.
They plan events with other mm-hmm. homeschool kids, or they plan events with other kids in the neighborhood, or
clubs.
They do sports.
Yeah, we have a cooking club. We have art. I mean, it's a very again, it's a private school we're paying for, so it's an actual school. But you know, there's all sorts of ways you can stay connected if you're that type of kid.
Yeah,
and I think it's just. You know, my look at parenting, which has come back to bite me in the butt, you know, my approach has always been, you parent the kid you get, okay? And if you have five kids, you do your best to kind of adapt it so that that's how your family parents. My kid, like, wants to really learn, doesn't want to, you know, thinks that most middle schoolers are stupid. I mean,
middle school is tough.
No, but she's like, why do you care?
They should abolish middle schools.
I think they should, too.
They
but,
should.
You know, so this is a good antidote right now for her.
What's the Roseanne Barr quote you use all the time about the she has five kids, whatever it was? Aren't you the one who quotes this all the time? I thought I have four
she's
kids, five kids, whatever it is, and basically said, you know, listen, I have four or five. I lose one. I still have
the
right.
Oh, that was the motto of my neighbors growing up.
Oh, that's
they had,
okay.
They had 12 kids, lose
okay,
a couple, what the heck.
Yeah. But, you know, Sue, getting back to the social thing, and by the way, your situation was in that you didn't have much of a choice. The transgender person you picked in Maine, obviously, I think people would say you don't put someone at risk or whatever. But the vast majority, I read a lot about this today, the vast majority of the growth of this homeschooling movement are people whose sole reason for mm-hmm. homeschooling is because I think the public schools are not doing a good job by my kid,
but,
right?
Yes, yes. And that's particularly true in a lot of these urban schools. This piece we read from New York Magazine was, of course, about New York City. And they talked about how there are people that are very unhappy with the public school systems there. They cannot afford to go to private school because it's a fortune. And so their option is to homeschool their kids in New York City. And these are people that make $50,000, $75,000. And it's usually the mothers that are doing it. And they get together in these groups. And it starts out with they're all together at the swimming pool. And the kids are all going to swim lessons in the middle of the day because they don't have a regular homeschool schedule. And they'll go on trips together.
Yep.
You know, this friend of mine that homeschooled, one of the big trips they did, which I thought was so neat, they all went together and they went down and retraced a lot of the big battles of the Civil War. They went to Gettysburg. Mm-hmm. They went to Antietam. They actually were there. And again, like your children, these kids all did phenomenally well.
Yeah, and they want to learn. I mean, that's where the match. If you have a kid who has a disability, a learning disability or a physical disability in some way, it would match. But it also allows the kid to see learning in a very different way. I mean, last night we watched Argo. Ruby and I watched Argo. Because we had been talking.
I hope it was not between 7 and 8 last night.
No, it was like 11 to 1.
Okay. Because I was watching. The kid doesn't go to public school.
Watching,
For people
you know,
that don't know, that's about the
that's
Iranian hostage crisis.
Yeah, you know, and she asked me, and it wasn't, and again, this is not because it's my kid. It's like when you focus in on a kid, you know, and show them what, you know, ask me questions about which are the good ones and which were the bad ones. Well, there really aren't because the Shah, you know, and we even watched one of the X-Men, you know, which actually goes, it had Nixon in it. You know, and asking questions about history in a context from the movie, which I don't think most kids would get because they don't look at it as, oh, I can learn from this.
Yeah.
We're talking to
you
Sue
know?
O'Connell, who's the publisher of Bay Windows, about homeschooling, which she is doing with her daughter, Ruby. There's a subculture.
Still not drinking, too. I just want to be clear.
There's a subculture, right, where you fall into when you become a homeschooler, either by choice or by necessity or that sort of thing. You mentioned the groups. But there is a subset. How does the subculture of homeschoolers look at everybody else?
Well, it's very I mean, it's very everything within the subculture of homeschooling is fractured. There's like a Facebook page for our particular platform that you've seen commercials for, and I'm not a paid spokesperson, the K12.org folks. And, you know, there are people who post things that don't have a very firm grip of the English language. And I don't mean as, I mean, native speakers who grammatically are just, it's a nightmare. And then there are these off conversations like, oh, great, maybe they should pay attention, you know. And then there's the religious stuff. And then when you're out in the world, you know, people, I think, are both horrified and fascinated. You know, that they, if they have more than one kid, they probably have a kid who would benefit from some of this in some way. But the time of it is just exhaustive. It is no way easy.
That's what I want to ask you about. Because you have a full-time job and plus you're teaching your child.
Right. And I'm a casual parent with a very strict kid. You know, so our big battles are, well, you said you'd be home by 10:30 this morning.
This is the kid
talking. Yeah, oh, yeah, and I'm ready to go. And, you know, and this, Marjorie, you'll appreciate, my electricity got shut off yesterday because I forgot to pay the bill.
Oh,
God. I know you've been with me. I know this has happened to you.
It has happened to me,
so,
yes.
You know, I run a, and I know you're looking, now you're judging me, Jim.
I am,
so,
actually. Well, you're so insightful.
So I ran a wire, a cord from the lobby of my building into, you know, what the heck, right? They'll be there today. And Ruby's just like, well, now I can't work. I can't work. How am I supposed to work? Why didn't you pay the bill? How am I supposed? I'm like, Ruby, that's the whole point of this. You can just, we can go to Starbucks, you know. Oh, no, I can't do it. You're going to have to call in and tell them I'm absent today because you didn't pay the electric bill.
Oh, God.
And that's what our battles primarily are about.
Yeah, but it's about the battle. See, my now that I've gotten over my uninformed bias,
yes,
which I have, by the way, despite what Marjorie's going to say during the next segment, I've gotten over the two problems that I can't get over, and I'm trying to. Is one, the whole socialization thing. Because despite this group
challenge
thing, let me just say, from personal experience, a person who was not very outgoing, like your kid,
mm-hmm,
and had a lot of social issues, I did when I was younger, being thrown into the cauldron is much more valuable than having structured interactions.
Right.
That's one. Second thing is, you know what it drives me nuts? Like, I got into a thing with Jeff McCormick and Evan Falchuk running
just
for governor.
Just basically everybody ran.
No. but two business guys. And you'll understand the relevance in a minute. I've asked both of them a lot of times. You would never hire, both successful business guys, a brilliant politician with no business experience to run a business, right? No. So why should the public hire a great business person with no political experience? You don't know anything about teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Teaching is an art that is really difficult, whether it's one person or 30 kids in a room. I've known you for many years. You're really smart. You're really clever. You don't know anything about teaching.
Know a damn
thing. She does now.
No, but you know what? Because I have this system that does the prompts. Like,
right,
they take an assessment test, so they get put into the class that they are supposed to be in.
Yeah.
And then it's basically just, you know, they read the chapter, they follow the lesson plan on the computer, then they take a quiz at the very end.
What
and
happens
they move
when
right
she has
on
questions?
She asked me, and I have the answers. I have an answer key.
Oh, you mean off that?
Yeah.
But if her questions go beyond the confines of what the
lesson
is.
All right, I'm going to say something that's going to tick every teacher off listening to us right now. I have corrected Ruby's history tests in fourth and fifth grade and gone in and argued points because the teacher had the answers wrong and had the wrong interpretation of the Constitution of
Marjorie's
the United States.
Marjorie's going to blame
it
on the teachers.
I'm not
going to
blame it on the teachers union, but I think that there are teachers, and teachers are already mad at me, that don't know the English language,
mm-hmm,
and they're supposed to be teaching
children
English.
So every
English
time, I mean, I've always tried to be the parent who didn't get involved with the teachers and let them do their job, you know, but there were three occasions where it was just like, the answer is wrong. You're teaching the Constitution in the wrong way and didn't have a clue what I was talking about.
Well, there you go. And here's another thing that I think I think we should abolish middle school. I think it should always be K through 8.
You know what they should do? They should go out, half the kids or the kids that should go to an outward bound camp for 2 years. Another bunch of them should go to organizational school for frontal lobe organization, and the rest should go to high school.
But here's my theory about why there should be no middle schools, because it's an awful thing when you are 10 or 11 and 12 as a kid and you may be awkward to have to go reinvent yourself in a new school and establish yourself with the cool kids and the not cool kids.
And
if
it's
you
vicious.
Stay
it
K through 8th grade in the same school, and Brookline does this, and it's one of the best things they do,
mm-hmm,
is that you never have to reinvent yourself.
Right.
By the time you get to high school, you're 14, you're a little bit past that worst,
mm-hmm,
those first early hours and weeks of puberty. But the point I was going to make about homeschooling is that think back to the kids that you knew in school, and I think back to some of the kids I knew in school who were totally tortured. If they could have eliminated those 2 or 3 years of torture and then gone on to high school or college,
they'd have a better experience. They'd have a better education.
Yeah, and not have to, because kids can be
brutal. I mean, the social thing is important, you know, and that's the other, not being a teacher thing for most people is important too, but if you use the right programs, you could just answer the questions. But if you're truly homeschooling, the kids can still play sports at your local school. They can still go to all the clubs. Some schools even say, hey, come in and do art. Come in and do music.
Yeah, but they don't go to school with these kids. They don't
but
have
they're in
ongoing
their neighborhood
relationships.
They're with other kids. And if, like I said before, if you're a kid with some issues,
all
you don't have to be with the bullies, Jim.
You just needed one friend.
Exactly.
That's all you needed.
You did need one friend. It was a tragedy. We all recognize that.
One or two more things here I want to say. say, Marjorie, who is acting like she is this incredibly enlightened soul about homeschooling, I want to get back to
just
share with you, and this will be relevant, I think, to your experience. We had a caller when we were talking about this a couple of years ago on our other former radio
life. Jim is obsessed with the subject.
Who said, I was a huge homeschooler, but I have to say, after X period of time, whatever it was, if I saw my kid one more minute, I was going to like shoot myself. Let me finish. Marjorie interrupts and says, I shouldn't admit this on the air, but here's the story she told. I was so excited. I hope this is okay. Oh, the kids are not in town.
You told it before.
And she's a fabulous mother. I know that for a fact. Marjorie said, I was so excited, Marjorie said, when my first kid was coming home from college. And when the kid was home for a week, it was a little less exciting. Kid had 2 weeks. And the end of her story was, which is relevant to the homeschooling thing. I mean, you'll understand the point, is after a month, when the kid finally left, I was dancing around. Uh-huh. And she loves her children. The notion that a person is going to spend all day and night with their child, to me, is insane.
It is insane. It's awful. Yeah, no, I'm not going to beat around the bush. It's like, you know, the worst time to have an argument with me is just before I go to bed. Like, it's, you know, it's like that 5 minutes you have that's just to yourself. And inevitably, Ruby will start, you know, she'll come in and say something that just makes me get into this Irish rage. And I'm like, I can't see you anymore. Go away.
Okay, last thing. So based on your, putting aside for a moment, you're doing it what you believe to be out of necessity. Give 60 seconds of fair-minded, I mean this sincerely, based on your fair-minded advice to somebody who is saying, well, I have a choice. I'm not in Sue's situation. Should I? Shouldn't I? What's the advice?
I think you should buy the pro. If you're to look at the pros of it, do a good old Ben Franklin pros and cons list. Buy one of the programs. There's a number of programs out there with the educational supplies that you need. It should make your life easier, not more complicated, so you can get the books and the laboratory stuff. Make a socialization plan, whether it's going to be within the group that you're in or somewhere else that you stick to. Scheduling is the most important thing, and also making sure that you're meeting the needs that your child has, not the needs that you think your child has.
That's pretty good.
And one last thing. Mm-hmm. You can save a ton of money because lots of people move to towns based on where the school system is.
I can move anywhere I want.
And you don't have to worry about it. You could be in Podunk, USA.
I'm a millennial. I don't own anything anymore. I rent an apartment. I rent a car.
You know what Sue did, by the way? Because she was really sick, but she suspended her child. I mean, really... It was horrible.
Actually, I got suspended.
So it's great to see you.
Thank you.
Okay. Sue O'Connell is a casual parent and the co-publisher of Bay Windows.
Of a strict child.
Yes. Southend News, thank you for being here. Up next, we're going to open up the lines and ask you about homeschooling. Parents, teachers, those of you who are homeschooled, those of you who are homeschooling right now, we want to hear from you at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And if you're just tuning in, we were talking to Sue O'Connell of Bay Windows and South End News fame about homeschooling. If you're a parent, someone who was homeschooled, a teacher, what is your take on homeschooling? Do kids get shut out of the social experiences that help shape a childhood? Is it financially hard? Is it taxing to teach your kids? If you made the decision based upon necessity, as Sue described, or is it because you're dissatisfied with the school system? If you've done it, tell us about it. If you've contemplated, tell us about it. And if you have ruled it out for whatever reason, the uninformed ones like mine, or you've done some research, let us know. The number is 877-301-8970. I have to say, the two things that I said to Sue were the two things that motivate my inability to wrap my arms around this is, one, the lack of school. I know you are too, despite your teacher and anything. Teachers, good teachers, are really
great. They're
artists.
They change your life.
And if you don't do that for a living, the thought you could do it with your most important people in your life, your children, is hard for me to accept. That's number one. And number two, I don't. As someone who had some social issues when I was a kid, I don't mean like, you know, I mean just, I wasn't.
Everyone can recognize
your
social
issues. Well, fine, okay. Fine, thank you for helping me with that. it just, you have to be thrown, and I don't mean if you're bullied or something, obviously. Every kid needs to be thrown into the environment that's real, like the real world. Yeah, Homeschooling is not the real world.
But the real world for certain periods of childhood is a very nasty and hostile world, and I think if you're, you know...
How do you learn to deal with it, Marjorie?
Well, I think you can
Bullying. I'm not talking about extremes.
But I do think that's what happens to a lot of kids. They're not invited to the parties. They're the last kid picked on the team. They don't do well in school. They struggle. Those kind of kids, I mean, I think every situation is different. And I commend these people because I could not do it myself. I would be the first person to say...
You don't think you're shortchanging the kid? I don't mean in those situations, again, where obviously there's a physical issue, there's a psychological issue, you're trying to have them avoid bullying. But in a situation where you just decided, well, the public school is not good enough for my kids, so I'm going to sit home even though I have no idea what I'm doing, and I'm going to be my kid's teacher.
Well, I think a lot of people feel as though the public schools are failing. In some cases, in the urban America, they've failed. So you're obviously not missing out on an education if you take it into your own hands, if you have the wherewithal to do it. If you want your kid to succeed, I think that's what a lot of these parents in this New York City story were talking about. They weren't going to send their kids to public schools in New York City. They were going to take their kids. I'm sure there are some great public schools in New York City, like there are some great public schools in Boston, but it's very difficult to get into those great schools. And if you're faced with a bad school or taking matters into your own hands, and you can do it, I can understand completely why people do it. Kelly from Gloucester, you're first this hour on the homeschooling issue. Hi, Kelly.
Kelly, are you the Kelly we know from days gone by?
Yeah, and actually, when I met you, Jim, in that Whole Foods parking lot, when you were so distracted by your cell phone, I was with my children. Do you remember? And I was homeschooling them at that time. Yeah.
Before you go ahead, by the way, when Kelly introduced herself to me in a Whole Foods in Cambridge, Marjorie and I had just been on the radio. Correct me if I'm wrong, Kelly. And Marjorie had been criticizing me for looking at my cell phone 24/7. I had said that's totally untrue. Kelly walks up to me to introduce herself. What am I doing in the parking lot of Whole Foods?
Looking at your cell phone.
And Kelly, one last thing before you make your point about homeschooling. I would like to point out that every person that calls the show to say they met Jim, it's always in the same place.
It's at
the Whole Foods, either in the parking lot or more likely at the hot bar. So tell us about homeschooling.
You were a homeschooler, Kelly, right?
So yeah, I was. And I have a really good kind of, you know, handle on this whole thing because I did it when my kids were little. I had four kids. I have four kids. And you know, my children went to school when Sadie was in the fifth grade, Nora was in the third, and Jonah was in the first. And you know what? It was very sweet when they were little. I have kind of people say to me, oh, your kids are like homeschooly kids. They're kind of quirky and funny and really nice kids. We're very close with them. But my God, I could not wait. I love school now.
Why? Yeah. What was it just because it was right for the time? Is that your point, Kelly?
Well, you know, first of all, I'm not a teacher. I've learned that I can't do everything. I got a degree in social work because I wanted to work, and I wasn't doing that at that time. And I feel like as a mother, we put so much on ourselves. And a lot of the homeschooling moms I know are just trying to do everything, you know?
Yeah, you're exhausted.
And I'm really happy to hand my children over to really wonderful teachers. I'm lucky. My kids all go to great schools, and we've had a great experience in the school system. I'm so happy that I've sent them to school, and I was willing to kind of see that Sadie wanted to go to school. She wanted to be with friends. When I ask her now, like 4 years later, I say, like, you know, what's your favorite thing about life? She says, my friends. I get to see my friends.
Hey, Kelly, before you go away, when you were homeschooling your kids, and I don't remember, I'm sure I asked you this years ago, were there social deficits? I hate that expression. Were there social problems because they weren't with the other kids all the time?
Yeah, you know what? When my kids were young, I do feel like it was okay when they were young because I would just say we didn't do a lot of school. You know, I just took them to the park and we played and we hung out and they didn't miss a lot because my kids fortunately were early readers. They all just were kind of self-driven. You don't need to do a lot in school until the fourth or fifth grade, really.
You know,
they learned how to write. They learned how to add.
Got it.
And we just spent a lot of time playing with doing music. My family does music with other people and hanging out. But, you know, fifth grade, sixth grade, they didn't want to hang out with me all day long. And I didn't really want to hang out with her either.
Hey, Kelly, please say hi to your husband. And it's really great to talk to you. We haven't talked in years. Thanks for the call.
And you know what else is great about Kelly's call? That people don't necessarily homeschool K to 12.
Yeah, no, that's a
you
very
know,
good
they
point.
They may do it for a short period of time. Like my friends I mentioned in Andover, they homeschooled their kids and they sent them to school. They went to Phillips Andover. over that fantastic prep school when they get older. So it wasn't a lifelong experience.
Speaking of the bullying thing or being treated poorly, what I should have asked Kelly, and I'll ask the next person who calls who is a homeschooler, is how do the kids, when you let you go for sports, as you and Sue talked about, or you go for French club or whatever you're allowed to go to in the public school, even though you're homeschooling them on the academics, are they treated differently by the kids? Oh, you're a homeschooler kind of thing. I mean, that to me,
I don't know,
but we'll get to somebody. Oh, Claire in Medford, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call, Claire. Hi.
Hi, it's so great to be on air.
Well,
I'm actually a homeschooler. I've been homeschooling my entire life. And I'd just like to say that homeschooling has really given both me and my sister an opportunity to pursue our passions and do things that we wouldn't be able to do if we were in school.
Like what?
Wouldn't have. For example, I give the example of my sister because, I do music. I feel like her thing is more impressive. She single-handedly started her own theater company, doing primarily Shakespeare, and she's built a community and been able to play Hamlet and King Lear all by herself.
Wow.
Wait a second, Claire, I may have misunderstood you. Were you homeschooled using you were a student who was homeschooled.
Yes.
Oh, great.
Yes, I am.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, as far as myself, I do a lot of music, so I've had the chance to really pursue that, and I perform professionally. I've been able to seek out opportunities that my peers who play music in school just don't have the time or resources to do.
So really Claire, you're the perfect person to ask, obviously, because you've been homeschooled. What about the friend issue?
So that has been absolutely no problem for me. With homeschooling, you're really driven by what you like to do. So through what I like to do, I've found friends. And in addition to that, there's a big homeschooling community in the Boston area.
Mm-hmm.
And I know so many homeschoolers who are my friends. I have so many friends who are in school we have the same interests, so we've connected. Finding friends has been no problem for me.
And Claire, last question. Friends in your neighborhood who are not homeschooled but went to the Medford or wherever public schools, did they treat you any differently as a neighbor and friend or no?
Jim wants to know if they thought you were a weirdo, Claire.
Well, that is. I mean, I wouldn't use that word, but that is exactly what I'm asking. What's the answer to that, Claire?
When you tell people you're homeschooled, there's usually an initial kind of confusion and get a lot of the same questions. People are very curious about it. But after that initial, well, you're homeschooled, people just see that you're another person who has a different way of going about your education, and it doesn't have any long-term effect on any relationship that I've ever had.
Hey, Claire, if you said this, I missed it. My apologies. Why were you homeschooled? Did you tell us that?
Oh, sure. So my parents, actually I have two older siblings, and they were pulled out of school because my parents just thought that homeschooling would give a better opportunity to have basically what I said, have us pursue our passions.
Got
and
it.
My parents just weren't happy with how we were being educated in school. And,
got it.
Great.
Yeah, what do you play, by the way? What do you play, Claire?
Oh, I sing. I sing jazz.
Oh, great.
Oh, neat.
Hey, Claire, if you sing jazz, hang on a second. We're going to take your number. We may be in touch at some point. Claire, don't go away. One of our producers will get your number. Claire, thanks for the call.
Thank you for that great call. Maureen in Hanson. Hi, Maureen.
Hi, how are you guys?
We're excellent. Thank you for calling, Maureen.
I have homeschooled since my son was in kindergarten. He is a senior this year. We homeschooling in this day or in the each town is different. And up until high school, I did all of the schooling. And then for high school, he will have finished 80 credits at Massasoit.
Wow.
Yes.
Now, Maureen, how many kids do you have?
I have one. When I hear these stories of people having four kids, I just don't know how they do it because it was all consuming.
It was.
Yes. We did a classical trivium, so I mean I'm pretty disciplined, so he is similar to me in that way because I was trying to find the thing that worked for him. The impetus to homeschooling was he started playing the piano at three.
Wow.
Yes, and so we were looking around, and I was looking at some private schools, and my God, the cost is unbelievable. But it was more, we live in Hanson. We didn't really want to move. And the drive, how do you like make a five-year-old commute an hour? You just really can't do that. And so that was how it started. And then it was really just, I'll do kindergarten. That's how I started, honestly. And we are secular. So there were groups out there that, and now it's been 18 years. So he's 18. And back then, there were not a lot of groups. And the groups that were available were all religiously motivated and were not open to a secular member.
So what was the relationship like? How did you and your it's son, you said, right?
Yes, it is.
How did you coexist through all those years? What was the relationship like?
Well, you know, I have to say, I really believe that you need to have a very compatible relationship to do this with your kid. I think it wouldn't work with a kid that is like, you know, no, I can't listen to you. But no, you know, we did. We had a good relationship through the whole thing. But, you know, when we started getting to high school, I really felt like, okay, we got into algebra, and I thought, oh, my God, what am I thinking? So we used a tutor for the algebra.
Yeah, I got it. Hey, Maureen, I think we lost you. Maureen, thank you for an excellent call. We didn't mean to cut you off. If we did, it was inadvertent. By the way, Callie Cross here, a colleague called, and she wants to mention a book by Paula Penn Nabert, I think it's how you pronounce it, an African-American woman who wrote, quote, "Morning by Morning, How We Homeschooled Our African-American Sons to the Ivy League." So there is obviously a racial component in some of this decision making too. And by the way, I'm sure there are angry emails that Marjorie is being kind enough not to read. I am much more tolerant. I really did have biases that were uninformed about this because early on, and I still have concerns, but they're not as uninformed. Let's
put
it that
way. Well, here's a great email, actually.
What's that?
From Mary Ellen says, "We lived in New Mexico. The schools are ranked 48th in the nation. I knew my daughter would not be prepared for later. We did the K-12 program. She went on to an elite prep school and now Smith College." There you go, Jim. "She always made excellent grades, socialization not a problem, Girl Scouts, church activities, homeschool clubs, etc. Sang in the adult choir at church from a young age, and which is more like real life than being pigeonholed in a certain grade. As far as teaching, I respect teachers being able to be in a classroom all day long with many children, but it's not rocket science. With your own child, you have the best sense of what your own child needs."
Well, I should have asked this of Maureen, since she homeschooled her kid, I think she said from K through 12, did she not? The whole way there. So how much of a culture shock was college for you? Big one, right?
Yes.
Well, it was huge for me.
But
I went to a really big high school, and I went to a really big college, and it was still a culture shock for me. How does a 18, 17-year-old kid who's been homeschooled their whole life deal with that? You go from essentially being in a – oh, we have somebody on the phone about it? Oh, we do. We have let's talk about timing. Alex in Abington, I didn't even know you were there. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for the call, Alex.
Hello. How are you doing?
Great. Fill us in.
Well, you just kind of touched on a point that was interesting. I started off homeschooling out of piano. I started playing piano when I was five, and I started homeschooling. I went to a Montessori school kind of thing, and then I was homeschooled again. Then I went to the choir school in Boston. I was there with it. Then I left that, and then I went to an arts boarding school in Michigan for performing arts. And it's the kind of thing that you by choosing to homeschool your children, I think a lot of parents kind of miss the fact that it is a counter. I don't want to say counter, but it's almost as a question to the established kind of ways of educating children. And I think what a lot of parents miss is that by doing that, you're starting to rear children who have a sort of they're different than the typical fashion. And I think parents can kind of miss that and then see their kids being different, developmentally, and see that as kind of a problem and start to, I think it's a great way of making kids just thoughtful and just making question the established ways of
doing
the
kind of.
So it's a good Alex. Alex, you said you went to a bunch of schools though. Were you homeschooled or did you go to a bunch of schools?
I was homeschooled. Yes, I kind of that was the thing that I think.
You were back and forth.
Yes, and I think and that's what kind of led me to the I was thoroughly homeschooled growing my well actually you know I but I when I was part of during my schooling I would have a we'd do Meals on Wheels, and actually once when I was a kid I called I think it must have been eight I think I
hey Alex in. We're losing this connection. I got to interrupt you only because we're losing the connection, but however, very quickly, do you have any regrets about having been homeschooled?
I think you know, I don't, because I the social issues that everyone raises with
me, yeah,
homeschooling, I think are present, and I think you adopt a different way of being, having social interactions with people. But
got it, Alex. We got to let you go. Thank you for the call. Unfortunately, we won't get to Vicky from Hamilton, and the note says Jim is driving her crazy.
Yeah, we also had a naysayer. We didn't get to Vicky. Him either. I'm sorry about that.
All of you,
it was
yeah.
Jim's fault. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Please tune in tomorrow. We've got Cornel West with us. He's going to be here to talk about
great.
Black leadership in the 21st century. Also, Jonathan Alsop from the Boston Wine School. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, Catherine Whalen, and our engineer today is John Parker, almost every day, actually. I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you very much for tuning in, and please tune in again tomorrow. Bye.